the clock, and we want to get it done. Out to you at the latest by noon on Monday, so you have enough time to look at the report. It will not necessarily be a lengthy report. It doesn't have to be, because what we're going to do is put all the submissions on the website. And to facilitate the processing of the report, as you heard, but we also wrote to people, is to say, instead of expecting our researchers will read in any case every submission, to do the summary, we expect you preferably to do the summary if you want, so that you're more accurately represented within 300 words. So thank you very much. Charles will take major responsibility for chairing this call.
Honorable Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, okay, just from a process point of view, we'll get the response from National Treasury today. As a committee, we'll talk about the submissions and the response when on Tuesday. Is that right?
No, we have to vote on Tuesday if you look at your program. This is the way we always do it.
No, it doesn't matter how we've done it, Mr. Chairman. I mean, we agree.
We vote on the report.
So when do we actually consider the input?
Which input?
The input from public, from National Treasury, and put our own views to our own proposals.
Well, you can do it as normal, which is you can give us your written submissions. Everybody is asked to do that at the end of today's meeting as normal.
Yeah.
And then we ask you to do it by, say, this evening. Sometimes, in fact, it's a norm that if you even gave it to us yesterday or this morning, we would have entertained them. We don't necessarily include everything. The two chairs take the political decisions on it. And then you have a right to say, I would like the committee as a majority to reconsider paragraph 8 of what we said that has not been included in the report. Then there's a three-hour meeting on Tuesday. We'll go through the report, as you know, line by line when it comes to the proposals, the recommendations and observations section. The summary section we don't go through here. And normally, as you know, you get it sometime between 1 o'clock and about 5 on Monday. But this time around, given the sensitivities around the VAT increase, we want to do it by, let's say, Monday morning 9. And in fact, we started the two chairs working on the proposals and recommendations that have emerged from the process so far. It's the same process, except we're going to make it easier for you to look at the report earlier. It's a normal process. But as you know, this is the last time. We finished with the money for the act. We will vote on it shortly.
Okay. Mr. Jim, it's just that I'm a bit concerned that we're not going to get the opportunity to actually talk to our proposals at some stage.
We'll talk to you at the end. Look at the end, what I tried to do, what I tried to do. You see, it's the same product. I think you've forgotten, right? You should get younger people in your committee, Mr. Leeson. You respect. There's nothing...
Mr. Chairman, you only give me 3 years.
Okay, so what I'm saying... No, we're dealing with process, so let me finish. Yes, but... No, hang on, can I finish? What usually happens, now if you want to change the process, then you must change it. But this has been the norm since 2020. No, let me finish. Because I'm saying to you what usually happens at the end of this morning is I summarize some of the key recommendations for the researchers to start looking at. At that time, all parties, not just the DA, we give you a few minutes to say, we would have done it on Wednesday, except that we finished late. What normally happens is, when we finish at 1 o'clock, please, we've been through this before. Tani, no.
No, Chairperson, you don't even know what I'm going to say.
But not yet. You will be allowed to speak when I've finished. Now, here it is. Up to now, we've done it like this. At the end, at 1 o'clock or so on a Wednesday, we normally ask people, do you want to assist with recommendations? What are your proposals? And then we type it up, all of us, the team and the two chairs, and we include it. That comes from every party, even the EFF. Now, this time around, because we finished at 6 o'clock, we didn't ask you to do it on Wednesday. And then again on the Friday, what we ask you is, can you give us proposals, colleagues and comrades, on what you think should go into the report? Because we have the weekend to work on it, and we would like to get some guidance. Then we have a situation where study groups meet, like in our case, met on Tuesday, which gave guidance to the chairs, the two chairs were there, on what it is, for example, the ANC wants. So there's no difference to the process. It's not the DA alone that's going to recommend. We've always done it like that. If we don't do it like that, whether it's ANC, DA, or PAC, how are we going to draft the report, the two of us? The two of us do the section that deals with recommendations and nominations. We need guidance from you. So we'll give you about 20 minutes to half an hour for that. Everybody will have a chance to speak. But having said that, that's the process. Why do you want to change the time?
You see, the thing is, you always want to think on behalf of other people. You can stop that, you know what you want to speak into the place.
I'm giving you out of order. This is the way we've done it until now. You are part of it. Thank you. Now move on.
Chairperson.
Chairperson.
You must not assume that I'm going to speak on issues that are on your mind, that I'm insisting on this. I want to raise an issue here, and an issue that is an observation I've made from watching the meeting of the program committee, what the GA was doing there. There is now an intention by the GA to stop committees from processing either legislation or issues. That's why I say don't assume what I'm going to say.
Issue, yes.
Now what they are doing is to say that there's no adequate time that has been given to processes of parliament. They've done that yesterday in the programming committee. They wanted the wage bill to be stopped because they said what he is saying as we speak. So it's not innocent that he's saying that the DA is taking a posture that is going to delay processes. So even the announcement of VAT is not going to be different. And I request the chairperson to go and watch that
point
clip.
Of order, please, Mr. I have not at any stage indicated any delay. I've listened to the process and I've agreed and I've moved on. I think that it's completely out of order to start implying that I am here trying to delay the process. That is not true, and it really is out of order.
Now, I do a point of order. Can I draw attention as a chair, I'm not facilitating. Given what happened over the financial sector regulation bill, given what happened about the insurance bill, Tandy is absolutely right to raise these issues. But that is separate from the process. Now she's right to speak. Tandy, go on and speak. You have every right to raise it.
Chair, I call on the chair to go and watch yesterday's clip. You will see the consistency of what they've done in the committee and what they did in that committee. The same way, the same thing. And the speaker had to say, having listened to all of you, there is no issue that is being discussed here. You had an ample time, and I want you on record. That's why I'm raising this thing.
Because they
pretend that there's no ample time to consider submissions. They were saying exactly the same in that meeting. They said exactly the same in the past processes of our own discussions here. So I'm warning the meeting that needs to be aligned to it.
That's fine. That raises the right time. I was dealing with what the process is. I thought you were questioning that. So you were not questioning that, and you were wrong to raise it when you did. But you're right to raise it now. If you were chairing, you'd say the same to me. But I won't behave like you, Tandy, and be fair, wasting time here. You're absolutely right. Can I just say before you speak, or please, because I'd like you to respond, why it may not be the intention of Mr. Lees to do that? Tandy is perfectly correct to raise it, given our bizarre, that's it, bizarre. There was a lie in the one case, an absolute lie. And let's be frank, we won't mention names. The person who agreed to it the first time around, we have to respect that person because of the seniority. The person had it wrong. You will know, Tandy, when I went to discuss it with everybody, they were bemused. It was a lie that you were here. I was at the parliamentary network meeting. You then told me the bill was formally tabled even in the committee, right? It was a lie, wasn't it? It was a lie. So, Tandy, I entirely 100% agree with you. Thank you. Right. Okay, can you respond to that? She's right to be suspicious, and so am I.
Chairperson, thank you. I just want to draw your attention that I handed a letter to the chairperson of the Select Committee, and I just want that to be monitored. In essence, it boils down to the fact that we don't have a problem if we have joint public hearings, but the joint meetings, we object to that, and we just want that to be monitored. Thank you, Chairperson.
No. The fact that
that you are correct to raise what you did does not mean you are correct to interrupt while we were describing the process, nor question the process that you were complicit in. You're the longest serving member in this committee. You're just as guilty if the process is wrong. Right. Now, so I unapologetically repeat that I stopped Tandy at the right time. Now, having said that, Tandy made a very good point. By the way, Tandy, you'll be pleased to know Mr. Comrade Chal has got a letter. All of which is correct, but it still doesn't detract from the absolute wrongness as an experienced member of parliament for you to say that you're not complicit in the whole correct process. Now, can I say to both of you, I haven't seen this letter, we are categorically clear as the ANC Tandy, and if you dispute what I'm saying, then you must leave this meeting, because you have no mandate to say anything different from me. We are absolutely clear that the processes by which we are dealing with the fiscal framework in terms of participation by the public and in terms of processing by members of parliament is not adequate. Before, Tandy, you saw the programming committee, Charles and I agreed last week Monday, to issue a press statement before the hearing, which we read out to you. Now, the Money Bills Act, which we have informally adopted on Tuesday, and which we voted on in the next 2 weeks or so, actually, Mr. Terablanche allows for that. So whatever the issues are, and the civil society needs to know this, we are as excruciatingly pained by this process, as you will know, for those of you who come here, for the last 2 years and more, in fact, from 2014, and now we finally dealt with it. So there's no more 16-day thing. It ends this time round. And we are going to reply to these things. They'll come up in the debate on Wednesday, and we will have Tandy the responsibility at the right time to speak about it. She won't stand up and Mr. Manion's ranting and raving there. She will speak when she speaks, right? Because there she'll have to respect the speaker, unlike, I think, you know the problem with Comrade Chair? We are two buddy-buddies. From now on, I'm going to call her Miss Tobias Pocolo. So we communicate that this buddy-buddiness is ending, Tandy. Good point. I'm glad you raised it. Finally, I want to tell you. You know, if you tell us, Tandy, finally, that we, you know, I told you so. While they were speaking, by the Tandy, I was thinking the same thing, but I wasn't going to raise it. Thank you for raising it, Tandy. Yes, my friend, it's up.
Chairperson,
yes, thanks for the opportunity. Chairperson, just, I don't want to get into an issue. I hear and I respect what you say.
So why are you?
And I want to tell you that. So if you'd allow me. No worries. Chairperson, you know, as my colleague Oki alluded, the issue is very simple, and we realize that the Money Bills Act will probably assist to correct the scenario where, are you listening to me, Jim?
Are we listening where? We'll correct the money. How long do you think I've been in Parliament?
Many years. Cool. Sure, listen. What are the point? The point I'm trying to make is that.
Ask me what you said. I'll repeat every word you said. You're not going. You don't want to get involved in this thing, but you are going to get involved. You're listening to Archie's, and you realize the Money Bills Act is fair. And Chair, will you listen? Are you listening? Right. Every word I've got. What more you want? Any test you want to put me to? Please.
Right.
Chair,
the point I'm trying to make is that we have a problem, and I assume and hope that it will now be corrected when, as you say, the Money Bills Act will probably be adopted in 2 weeks' time.
It is, my brother.
The issue is that the joint meetings, we take the hearings, but the problem is for us in the MCOP that we, obviously being a different house, in terms of the legislation and the laws, we are looking at representing the provinces. So we find it difficult when we want to table our recommendations on a report. We find that when we come to a meeting like next week, there is a report that is tabled, which is done between you and the chairperson of the select committee. The report is deliberated on in the NCOP in a separate meeting, not in a joint meeting. And that is where the point is that when we get to our separate joint meeting, we are in a position where we find it difficult there to then put in our report or our recommendations, we find that we are now having to rubber stamp a report that has essentially come from the NA together with the NCOP chair, but we have it in separate meetings. Suddenly now the joint meeting stops, right, NCOP guys, here is the report that was deliberated on, tabled, approved, voted on. We find it difficult at that point in time then to table our alternatives, if I can put it that way. And this is the point we're trying to make in terms of the procedure. And I'm sincerely hoping that with the adoption of the new Money Rules Act, this scenario will probably be resolved. But we have no problem in taking the joint briefings. We have a problem is that when it comes to adopting the report, we have a separate meeting and we're told, it's like, if I can put it in simple English, it's kind of shut down the throat. It's too late for you to table your amendments. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair.
Co-Chair, I refer honourable members to page 10 of the Money Bills Act. Here it is. Go and read it. I'm not going to. We're spending 21 minutes debating this thing now, which is unnecessary. Because here's the answer. And we are reviewing this, and it's going to change. I'm talking now. When I speak alone. Take note of that. You can get the opportunity on Tuesday, before we vote on the report, to bring in your angle referring to provinces. Now, if you go and read all the previous fiscal framework reports, plus the MCBBS reports on the current and proposed fiscal framework, you will find the NCOP angle in those reports. You'll find it there. You can go back to 2009. I'm serving in this committee, deployed as a chairperson. So you'll find it there. It's our responsibility with a provincial mandate to bring that angle into that report. Because the Division of Revenue Bill is based on the fiscal framework. And you can go and read in the Division of Revenue Bill the consultation that took place regarding this whole process of fiscal framework, Division of Revenue Bill, appropriation bill. It's there. So bring that submission on Tuesday to the meeting when we're going to consider the report. That's a responsibility coming from Mpumalanga. I've got the same coming from the Northern Cape. But it fits into the bigger picture. It's not a standing alone thing. We go to a debate, you bring in your angle again. We go to the Division of Revenue, you bring in your angle again, the same with the appropriation bill. And there's the process. So we're not excluded as NCOP out of the whole process. No. Absolutely not. If you look at the total mandate of the South African Parliament.
You see, Chairperson, you will understand why sometimes I bring things in the manner in which I bring them. And it's the first time that I forgot my rule books, because I never thought you would do this. I left the joint rules and keep the rules. I need to remind the member. You see, committees of parliament are formal meetings. And in terms of the rules, they are an extension of the house. So we must not reduce joint meetings. It's written in black and white in the rule book. It's an extension of the house. Therefore, when we've got joint meetings, those are formal processes that are taken. So nothing stops people to make decisions from another house in a joint meeting. Okay. So unless people doesn't read the rule, I was going to show you the specific rule that speaks to that if I brought my rule book. This is the reason why, Provincial, I was bringing this thing, because I said to you, I've observed a delay tactic that the DA has been doing to try and undermine them. You see, the issue that's being raised is not raised for the first time. They are raising it again. And they do it right at the end of our discussions. Every time when we come to the end of the discussion, they do this. They want to take us back. They've been doing it. They are doing it. And And the reason why I wanted to come in before, I knew they were going to do it, even in this meeting. You see? And the only part where they are correct, it's when they say, in relation to the money bill, we need more engagement. We don't argue against that. We don't. But in terms of process, in the manner in which they are raising it, that's why I wanted to warn you before. Because I've done this observation. I'm happy that you had to raise it. Because you see, sometimes give me a chance because I do my own way.
Wrong. You could not have done it then. Can I raise something else before we go on? Can I see some clarity? We're losing a lot of time. People have flights. Already the lady said Tandi should got to leave because her flight is to Bombela. Yeah, but she has to leave early. Okay, fine. Can I just ask a question? Where's Frank Hilton? Frank is not here for some reason, really. But as I understand it, right, and this is a question I'm putting to you, Comrade Shah, because I'm not clear. Firstly, this has always been done like this, right? And I think I 100% agree with what Tandi said. Yet again, I don't agree with when she interrupted, but with the content, I refuse to budge. I'd rather die than budge on that. Now, the second thing is, can I ask this question, especially to you? Because I was thinking about it even last night as we were drafting the proposals and what you're going to report. Particularly, am I correct to say that the provincial perspective comes in the division of revenue law and in the appropriations law? Because you see, the appropriations committee deals with a provincial perspective around how much of money goes to the provinces and municipalities, right? And they also deal with division of revenue, appropriations at the national level, which also influence the amount of money that will go to the province. So for example, if you're giving 10 rands to health, that affects you a lot as a province, because that means each of the provinces get 1 rand, maybe, right? But if they gave 10 rands to international affairs, DIRCO, doesn't affect you so much because your province is not a concurrent function. So my view has always been sharp that actually on this process, even though we'll have more time, consideration should still be given to doing it like this. The advantage, in fact, is that firstly, we in the National Assembly give some new ideas and perspectives because you look at things from a different vantage point that we wouldn't otherwise have. Now you will get from us things, we look at the same thing from the same party. Charles, for example, when he makes his recommendations, he's thinking from the point of view of the NCOP, so he's always concerned about provincial issues. In fact, it's he, if you look at the report, that does most of that stuff. I don't do that stuff, because he's more accomplished. So I still think, even though we have more time, consideration needs to be given. I'm not saying it must be done. Consideration needs to be given to retaining the system. What we can do is seek a compromise, right? Where before we vote, now we're going to have the time, we have a bit of a separate discussion on the report from your side and your committee on that side, and we actually don't need it, because we don't exclude anything that Charles brings. I can't think of a single thing that Charles has said. There are some times I've raised with him and said, this stuff is because it's dealing with specific allocations. We should give the draft to the appropriations committee. But now he chairs both committees, and you are in both committees. So for you, you're more advantaged than us, because we have completely separate committees. So if the point is raised with the genuineness that you seem to be raising, Isaac, with due respect to the others, there's no hidden agenda that she refers to, then it's a legitimate one. And Tony says, we agree in principle. So what is the fuss about? We're going to have the time to do it now. But I would urge you look at what the Comrade Chair is saying. It's in the money bills act of joint public hearings. In fact, to be quite frank, your committees in the NCOP, wherever I've chaired, except for public enterprises, have always wanted to work with us because they feel they have more time and they work with us, right? Local government, we work always together. It has never been challenged in court and it has never been. So really, to be quite frank, I think this is interesting. It could have been done in 5 minutes, but having come to where we are, we'll put some provisions in the report about the process and we will take what you say into account. So we'll write a paragraph there that says, now that we have more time, consideration might be given. We'll say consideration. Hopefully many of us will not be back in the new term. Well, I won't be back, hopefully. We can look at it. Right. So in any case, what I'm saying is, come on, let's move on. We've heard you, we'll put something in the report, And I plead with you not to undermine the process, given that it's the last time we're doing it like this. Thank you.
And on Wednesday, provinces and the NCP will be part of the debate. Special, we call it special delegation. That letter has been sent out already. So that's been in the provincial angle as well. Honourable members, we spent now 30 minutes on this. Can we go forward? Are there any apologies? Standing comment,
Mr. Chairman, no, you can't do that. Sorry, I've had my hand up for some time, Mr. Chairman. Yes. I really, it's,
okay.
It's just...
My apologies, Honourable Lees, please put your point. My apologies, sorry.
Because, Mr. Chairman, the way that the DA members get treated in this meeting is clearly not the same as the ANC. The tone of voice, it's very obvious to me, Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to fight with anyone. I really don't. And Sean knows that. We worked together since 2009 very well, I thought. But nevertheless, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that you're right, I've probably forgotten. What I was hoping to be able to do was to listen to National Treasury, then go back and formulate our proposal and send you a this afternoon, if possible. Okay, but I'm not Tamania. Yes, indeed, Mr. Chairman. He's got a funeral today. And then send it through to you and then have an opportunity at some stage to speak to him. That's all I'm asking. I mean, that was my request. How long ago, Charles?
Covered.
2 hours ago.
Covered.
Covered. Right to raise it. But Tandy is right to raise it. I fully endorse what Tandy
said. Right. Please, let's go forward. You're all smiling.
But in
fact,
we've been through
that. Second point, Tandy.
I want to say my member, TKD, is as fit as the angle, she can't be here today.
Pardon?
One of my members has twisted the angle, became a member.
She's not her member, she means the study group member.
But it's for the minutes. It must be recorded in the minutes. Are there any other apologies from the Standing Committee on Finance? On Romania, yes, we know about that circumstances. Anyone else? There's a hand.
Mr. Mutashupin just asked me to apologize, he's gone for defense.
Yeah, he must, he must get to my camp. He's got a trip ahead of him. Select comment on finance, Mr. So, sorry?
I gotta get to now.
You've got a flight at 3 o'clock. Mr. Rendell, are there any apologies? Zero, although there's members not here, but we note Honourable Motla Shipping. Please take that into the minutes. Thank you. That covers the apologies. Treasury. We're going to listen to you. Welcome back to Mrs. Cindy August. She's wandering around here. Yes, Cindy. A nice place to see back. Thank you, Cindy. Momo, you and your team.
Chair, just as you have difficulty overseeing us, we have difficulties in responding in time, so I want to emphasize that our response today is, we should have put the word draft response, okay? Because we don't want to come here being accused that we got 10 ears and we haven't heard nothing on the hearing. So... So, if we obviously had more time, we would have responded like we do to the text proposals, to each key point in detail. We can't do that too directly today, but we try and touch on most of the points. And Chair, I think the issue really is that if you look at the budget process, when we introduced three-year budgeting, the idea was that it may be very difficult to change the budget that's just about to start, the financial year. But that there's a three-year budget, especially on the expenditure side, of course, which allows you to also focus on year two and year three. and that can sit, and obviously the more time you have, Parliament has the opportunity then to make strong recommendations on how to change the direction of spending. It's very difficult. In fact, let me say, even when many of us came in government in 1994, we had discussions with the outgoing government at the time, because it knew it was going to be outgoing, in 93, where we realized, hold on, we can't actually change the 94 budget too much. There's salaries to be paid, there's contracts to be honored. But if you looked at it from a two-year scenario, five-year scenario, you can actually change the direction on the expenditure side quite significantly. So I do think that certainly even at the time of the PFMA, the whole issue of when should the budget be tabled, it used to be in March, but it then was in brought to February, there was even an idea, why don't we table the budget in September or whatever. So a lot of these discussions, I'm saying, were held at the time, and for various reasons, some options were not feasible, but the three-year budgeting system, certainly the expectation was that Parliament would obviously play a much stronger role on year two and three, and obviously play a role on year one, but as you roll on, the year one is the year two of the previous year, so that should have been taken into account, and that's why if you look at the budget review, I think Annexure A, is a response to Parliament, and it's meant to respond both to the MTPPS, and that's why we introduced the pre-budget, okay, to say that to give you time to influence the budget, in addition to the 3 years, there's a pre-budget where you are looking at the macro macro projections, certainly on the level of expenditure, the level of revenue, the deficit, the size of the deficit, the division of revenue between the three spheres of government. All of those, I think, there's some rationale for that. There never used to be a pre-budget. There used to be just an adjustments budget. And the MTPPS is actually meant to be to kind of give you time to think about the big numbers before you get to the main budget. Obviously, when you get to the main budget, there are adjustments made, even on the MTPPS. But the Annexure A in the budget review covers the MTPPS, the recommendations made, as well as any previous recommendations that have been made by Parliament. So I do think that when there are a lot of issues about how little time there is now, I think the reality is that the financial year starts, the fiscal year starts on the 1st of April. And even for departments, for them to have the ability to spend, they need to know, have some certainty, this is how much money we're going to get, and therefore plan. The later a budget is approved, the more you give a department an excuse that they didn't have time to plan, and therefore the money they didn't spend, the underspending, so they begin to justify that. So in the three-year budgeting system, they should have no excuse. They know their year two and their year three allocations, and they should be planning, especially for the capital expenditure, what they should be doing when. So I do think, and we don't deal with that here, but the three-year budget system was meant to deal with it. That said, the tax proposals are 1 year at a time. They're not on the 3 years. And if you look at the two outer years, what we have on the tax for the two outer years, we just assume that the tax changes made for year one will continue in year two and year three. Okay. But if, like last year, wasn't it, when we kind of announced the kind of revenue gap for this coming year, we signaled that clearly these gaps will have to be dealt with tax increases. Okay. We didn't specify, or we don't necessarily specify by what amount, or which particular tax, we indicated the amounts. Because in a way, it's a bit early to make those tax announcements for various reasons. They're market sensitive, they change behavior, and also we don't really know the size of the gap, because that, as we've seen, did change over the year. So, Chair, starting with that perspective, I think we tried to look at what were the main comments from the public hearing. Obviously, the big issue that's come out is, and not surprisingly, let me say, that the increase in VAT is not acceptable. And I say it's not surprising because, to be honest, I think if we had increased any tax, you would have had a strong reaction, particularly any of the three big taxes, by whichever constituency which may be affected, and sometimes not the constituency that's directly affected, but the one that's technically paying, but the incidence of that tax may not actually fall on the people paying. So if you look at corporates, we'll show you how the incidence shifts. It's not the corporates really that pay. It's either the shareholders, it's the customers, it's consumers generally. But the increase in VAT, aside from that not being accepted, that the issue is, it's been said that it's regressive. And the other issue is that the VAT together with fuel levy will hurt the poor most. Now, we are just stating what's been said. I think all these points, for us, if we had time, we'd like to unpack it and see whether the statement is true or not. You know, is it very regressive, is it mildly regressive, is it neutral, is it mildly progressive? Because if you look at the submission, different things have been said. I don't think in any of the submissions that I've seen that alternative models have been presented. Yes, tables may have been presented, but it's obviously there's too little time for people to do that research, to support their statement. So I do think that even the statements that are made, when we say we want to engage, we will go to the parties that have made those points strongly and invite them to demonstrate to us, you know, what evidence have they used, do they have papers. Even if they start doing their research now, we would like them to provide that to us. We will listen to it, even if and when the budget is passed. We are always looking at the impact of any budget proposal, and particularly on any of the tax issues. Obviously, the second point is, if you say no to the VAT increase, what's the alternative? Okay. We've said as a department that it's always got to be one of the big three, given the size of the gap. People have put forward the issue of wealth taxes. They've put higher taxes on the rich through personal income tax, increases in corporate income tax, and higher ad valorem excise duties. I should add that some of these things have been done in this budget as well. But of course, the other issue is, do those taxes actually raise the amount of money that we actually require? So that's again an objective issue that we can look at, and we can look at amounts. And we try and answer some of that in the response today. People have said that PIT, personal income tax, corporate income tax, and property taxes are low. Some say they're high, some say they're low. Okay, so you have a range. Third point is that we need a higher increase on social grants because we didn't fully compensate through the VAT increase the impact on the old, and of course the point we made that people who are not old are not children, therefore saying that gap, I think got 18 to 20 to 60. We don't have much in the way of grants at all for those for people falling within that age range. Then of course there's been the issue of zero rating of food items, you know, whether the products that you have are appropriate, still appropriate because they represent an old basket, whether more items should be put in. And then some others also looked at non-food items, be it school uniforms, soap, white bread, etc. There's been suggestions that there should be a luxury VAT rate on some foods and expenses and on luxury items. I think we will try and show that we do have this, but we do it through an excise tax. You don't have to necessarily only do it through VAT, but you have both VAT and excise that can operate. The other main, just get on to the next one. Oh, sorry, it's right in front of me. Okay. The other issues that come up, of course, as I said, with some of the process issues, and I've dealt with that about the insufficient time. If I really want to be cheeky, I would say, you know, the money bills was produced by Parliament, for Parliament, not by us officials. And Parliament's very strong about its right to determine its processes, rightly so. I think the big expenditure item, yes, that's not been touched with sufficiently is the wage bill. Whilst a lot of the cuts were brutal because they dealt effectively with the non-wage part, the point is that the biggest expenditure item is the wage bill. And to the extent that, you know, of course, again, many say that it's relatively high when compared to other countries. You could even argue that compared for the value that you get from the public service, it is rather high. But there are others, of course, saying that more should be employed and so on. So the issue of the wage bill does need to come out in the public domain much more, I think. The issue of government should not be increased. Some have said our taxes are too high. They're one of the highest taxes in the world. I should add the Treasury doesn't quite agree with those statements, but it's been said. The issue of tax increases, that rather than tax increases, that we should be cutting down on wasteful and fruitful expenditure and sorting out the state-owned entities. And I think we agree with that statement. The problem is in the timing. Even if we did want to do it and we did it well now, it will still take 2 or 3 years at least to implement that. That means we still have a big deficit, a big revenue gap to fill currently. Okay. The next point is that the rate of reduction of deficit is worrying. It should be quicker because, as you've noticed, we have brought down the debt to GDP. And I think, Chair, this is an important point. When looking at this budget, the expenditure levels have risen when you take higher education and so on. We try and keep the expenditure ceiling and that's gone down, but when you have new step changes in your expenditure, you are going to have to get more money through some form of tax or use a charge. It's something that people don't like to talk about. That's why we like to say, in proposing more expenditure, it helps to also propose what revenue sources should be touched. And of course, typically, many expenditure departments would try and say, no, we want to bring this, but don't tell us it should be that tax or that tax. They want to almost say that there's no taxes that would apply, and it actually can be accommodated within the current envelope and so on. Those are things we deal with as a matter of routine with departments all the time. I should add, there's even been issues, and let me be controversial, okay? You've had the Border Management Authority bill. It's not fully costed. We haven't seen what the level of salaries are. The salaries are going to go up, even if they don't employ one more person, okay? None of that's been done yet. And perhaps Parliament should look at, when it's approved bills, shouldn't they be properly costed in the first instance? And does the current budget actually deal with those issues? So I think there's a lot of other expenditure items that are out there with promises of better delivery. But maybe I've been in the public service too long. I don't believe any of those issues until people demonstrate it with active proof that it will get better, because this is what we do, and we put our salaries on the line. You can deduct 50% of our salaries if it doesn't turn out. I think it would change the incentive structure.
It doesn't apply to MP too.
I think the other points that have been made is that zero rating will lead to abuses. Businesses will pocket the differences when you implement. Some of us are old enough to remember we used to have GST. And GST actually was very conducive to that. VAT has a bit of a self-policing system, but of course it can always be abused. So I think the point is taken that things can happen. I think the issue is that there should be more policies and incentives, and I should add, the more incentives you have, the less tax revenue. And Chair, this is one of the big issues. In the budget there's a very important table, which I want to bring in an Annexure B. It's important because we wrote an Annexure B in the trade, our tax unit. But it has a table, which is, and tax expenditures are expenditures, in a sense, it's revenue that's foregone for other expenses. So people have not paid that because they've got a tax incentive. Unlike the budget, when there's an allocation, you have to approve an appropriation bill every year. Yes, there are the issue of direct charges. We can deal with that. But direct charges and tax expenditures are not approved every year. In fact, I'm not sure why these things don't have time limits. I think every tax expenditure, the default should be that, like you've done with the ETI, Employment Tax Incentive, that they should be reviewed. Yes, some, let them argue that they shouldn't be reviewed, they have permanent features like their depreciation allowances, because you don't want to cause uncertainty, like in the mining industry and so on. But to the extent that you have these, and the amounts are considerable, Chair, if you look in 2015, and remember, we have to base this information on the sort of information that SARS, when it's assessed. So we've got 2015, 2016. You're looking at total tax expenditure of 159 billion rand. Okay. Even people have argued here very strongly not to give business incentives. I promise you, if we took away the auto car incentive, the unions involved there would not be very happy because lots of jobs would go. So, you know, these things should not be dismissed. I think that they play a role, but all I'm saying is they need to be reviewed now and then. And this is not done. And in fact, if you look at this, even on VAT, there are amounts there that we've got the 19 food, basic food items, 22 billion rand estimate. The one on fuel is another 15. On petrol, 15 billion, and there's a bit more for diesel and so on. So this is a very important table that I would like to bring to the attention of members. And I think requires much more transparency as well. Though we might be number one on transparency, I can tell you, there's still a lot more of improvements we can make on the transparency side. And by the way, other countries as well. And by the way, that's where you get the problem. If you ask them what their tax to GDP, they often will just give you their national government. Their subnational government, their states, for example in the US, that then impose state taxes, to get a consolidated picture of what the total tax is on companies. It depends on which state they are in the US, for example. So one needs to take all of this. So when you look at these comparisons, you need to always check. What are they including? What are they excluding? Because the national functions they have will differ from our national functions. And often subnational governments are excluded when such comparisons are made. I think, Chair, the other point too that's come through is with regard to revenue administration. And let me say, there are challenges in revenue administration. It is not true that it's only because of the economic cycle that SARS has collected less. There are administration challenges, and that is why there's a commission of inquiry that the President has referred to in his speech. And if you look at the Minister's speech as well, there's an important paragraph that deals with the issue of also sorting out the accountability mechanisms for SARS, because I think we do have governance issues there, and we do need to make sure that there's checks and balances. In a sense, we need to stress test whether the PFMA, the SARS Act, is when everybody is bad, you know, the minister, the head of department, this official. I can tell you it's very hard to uncover or to prevent the bad stuff happening quickly enough. Even when you know about it in Parliament, people can hide behind confidentiality, okay? So we need to reassess. Confidentiality shouldn't be an excuse to get around accountability. And I think that we do need to stress that, given the last few years, what we've come out of, and there has been massive corruption, I have no doubt about it, that we need to do something. And yet the important question is, do we do something about it as soon as we know about it, or do we wait? The longer you wait, or the longer we don't see, the problem gets worse. And so I think, Chair, just to conclude this section, when the public is appalled at the tax increase, because nobody also likes tax increases, when government is not fighting corruption, okay, is not dealing with wasteful expenditure, I think the public, it affects tax morality. And that's why, from the tax side, we've said that we are facing great challenges on tax morality. And a factor of that is the fact that we don't act. When funders say that they don't want to fund ESCOM because we tell you about this corruption and you do nothing about it, and you bring back Mr. Koko, okay, for example, you bring back Mr. Makwakwa, okay. In these issues, the issue is not just that the person is guilty, we're saying that's one issue, but is the institution doing everything in its power to demonstrate there's actually nothing wrong, and that and until the issue is resolved fully, I mean, it can't be that our labor legislation now protects people who are crooked. Perhaps that's also something we need to look at. Surely public servants like us should not enjoy labor protection when it affects the public interest. I think those are the hard questions that need to be solved. So coming to this budget, to make the obvious point, we can't solve all those problems, and even if we could, we can't solve them overnight and in 1 year. But that they need to be solved, I think, is going to be quite critical for the country. And I think what this budget is like a lightning rod, it's affecting all of those issues. So, Chair, I think just to get down then to the specifics, we won't try and deal like we do with the with each specific one, but I think we want to start off by providing the message that we are in a difficult situation where we do have to raise money, and if we don't, we face ratings downgrades, which will make the funding more expensive, which will impact on inflation, which will impact on the poor as well. Yes, one can argue about the extent to it, but that these things will happen, I think it's clear. I'm going to hand over to Ian. And Chair, there's a lot of slides. We won't go through all the slides in too much detail, but we felt that just for your information, we wanted to put it forward, because even the budget presentation that we make after the budget is very short. It doesn't really get into the detail. And to be honest, when we look at some of the comments, we do wonder whether even those who are commenting have actually read the relevant sections of the budget review. So we are willing to engage and to make sure, and I'm not talking about MPs, I'm talking about a lot of the comments, that it's important that we just bring out to people. We know they're not experts on the budget, they may not follow the budget all the time. So some, and they clearly don't have great resources, so the issue is helping them to see that the budget review does deal with much of the information that's requested, and should be the first document that people should look at when trying to assess budget.
Right, I'm going to give you 35 minutes for that. Welcome to our stakeholders that are attending this morning. You're going to listen to the Treasury and you can put a question or two and engagement from the members of the two committees. And we try and conclude this at about 12 o'clock because of flights members must catch joining, connecting to other flights, to other problems. Thank you. And it's Friday. Thank you.
I know.
You don't have even to apologize for that. No. You go to church, you go to church.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. So, as Mama has said, it was a particularly unusually long discussion on Wednesday, and certainly from the Treasury side, we felt the quality of the input, the quality of the discussion. We received very valuable inputs. We thought it was a very high-quality discussion, and we thank you for that. And we are going to try and cover a lot of ground. It was, as I said, we had a particularly large number of inputs, and we've gone through each of those in detail, and we've tried to highlight what we think were the overarching themes that came through repeatedly. So the first point we'd like to make is that there was a question around the real GDP outlook and whether or not these numbers are credible. And the most important point we think is that firstly we are seeing an improvement in agriculture and mining. We are seeing an improvement in confidence, and we are quite comfortable with these numbers. One of the things that we do before putting the budget out is to confirm that our numbers are broadly in line with other credible institutions, and certainly that is the case. And in addition to that, and I think this was one of the topics that came up, was, well, do we also stress test these numbers? Do we look at other scenarios? And the answer is yes, we do. We've looked in detail and built various scenarios, and these can all be found in Chapter 2 of the Budget Review. And really the first scenario is a downgrade with a relatively mild impact on GDP growth. The second is a very significant downgrade and fiscal crisis with a contraction in real GDP growth. And the third is a scenario in which the global economy picks up. It's a bit of upside risk. The economy picks up, South African economy picks up in line with faster GDP growth globally. But the really important point of these scenarios is that we think this budget is what's required to get the finances back on track and to avoid one of these very severe and dangerous scenarios that we put into Chapter 2, which would, as Mama has already said, put us into a very, very difficult position, because lower GDP growth means fewer jobs, higher poverty. And we think it's absolutely crucial that at this stage we stabilize the public finances and start to build space so that in future the economy can start to grow more quickly and investment can come back. And a big part of the uncertainty about where we are now is uncertainty around the public finances and the finances of state-owned companies, and the question about an upward drift in debt to GDP. So it's not as though these things happen in isolation. What happens to the public finances have a huge impact on general confidence levels, and general confidence levels feed through to investment, and investment feed through to growth. And one of the big problems we're facing at the moment is that real private sector investment is contracting just at the time that we need higher levels of investment to get the economy growing. And we make this point in Chapter 1 of the budget repeatedly. The issue is that South African economy is not growing fast enough, and the fiscus has been responding to that now for 5 years, more or less, since the introduction of the expenditure ceiling. But in reality, if we want to have a sustainable fiscus over the long term, if we want more jobs, if we want poverty to come down, we need faster economic growth. And this involves a series of interventions which are not just around stabilizing the public finances. This budget is a first step towards stabilizing the economy and getting us growing faster. But we require other interventions. And in Chapter 1, we have put this graph together. Basically what it says is we're currently growing. We think we're going to grow at around 1.5%. We've seen an improvement in confidence. That's the next step up, which we think gets us to around 2% GDP growth by the outer year of the medium-term framework. But additional reforms are required, and the Treasury has been talking about these now for several years in a row. It's around telecoms reform, a sale of spectrum, for example, barriers to entry, transport reforms, and so on. And that gets us to around 3.5% GDP growth over the next 10 years or so. And if we want to go beyond that, then additional reforms, improving skills constraints, and so on. So I just really want to emphasize again that the issue we are facing and have been facing over the past decade is that the economy is not growing fast enough. And the implications of that are what we are seeing currently in the budget deficits. So this is the first graph that appears in the first chapter of the budget. I'm not going to go into it in detail again, but the black line was where we were heading at the time of the NTBPS 2017. Now, a lot of discussion has been around specific tax instruments, specific decisions on spending and so on, and we are going to address those a little bit later, but the main point is the black line is an unsustainable trajectory, and we have to do something about it, and this budget is a response to that trajectory.
I think the issue there was in MTBPS was the black line, okay, if it did nothing. The steps that we've taken get you into that middle line. But if you notice, it's just flattening it out. Before, in the 2017 budget, we were hoping that it would actually start going down. And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the debt levels at the time of the MTBPS were already now getting us to where we were in 1994. When we took over, the government was running massive deficits before democracy. And so we have, in a way, lost 20 years, the last few years, by getting back to where we were. And this is a metric that funders look at. Okay, they don't see that going down. They conclude that lending to us is more risky, and therefore there's a bigger premium on what they charge. So this is, I think, really a critical graph to look at. It kind of sums up where we've got to indicate where we're going to, and that's got to be a good story to tell. If it's going up, you saw the strong reaction after the MTBPS. That's the kind of reaction that we get.
Okay, thank you. Sorry,
can we later maybe get more explanation on this? Just if we can spend 5 minutes just on it.
I think this is the probably the most important graph of the budget 2018, so let me spend a little time on it. So what we've been struggling with over the past few years is persistent increases in the debt to GDP ratio. And you can see this graph, if you take it back further, our low point, the debt to GDP low point, was in 2008-09, before the global financial crisis kicked in. And at that point, our debt was below 30% to GDP. And since then, the economy has grown very slowly, and we've taken certain policy decisions. So immediately after the financial crisis, for example, we chose to increase spending, even in the face of declining tax revenue, and that did give a major counter-cyclical stimulus to the economy. But since then, spending has effectively stayed flat as a share of GDP, and taxes have started to recover, and in addition, taxes have picked up somewhat on the back of significant increases over the past 4 years. Now, the main issue is that consistently GDP growth has performed more poorly than we had estimated previously, and this is not a National Treasury specific issue. It's an issue that we'll see if you look at any of the, for example, World Economic Outlook forecasts. We've consistently underestimated real GDP growth. Overestimated, and when the lower GDP growth has come out, we've had very large revenue shortfalls, and effectively we've continued to borrow to fund that gap in order to maintain our social expenditures, for example.
So can I just read the chair's procedure that's worrying me? We need guidance, because the chairs don't dictate, unlike what some of you say. You see, it's unfair to call the public here and then listen to Treasury for like close to over an hour, and then when the public replies, and this is their parliament, then we say, okay, we're rushing for flight. So I would like to speak to all members. Do we invite the civil society here? Some people, we plead them not to fly from Joburg, the Cape Town-based people I see mostly here. Sean comes from Johannesburg. The question we have to ask ourselves is, how many people can stay till 1 o'clock? I can, because I'm not flying out today. But how many others can stay? because then we'll have to change the time. It's not fair to call civil society here, because then it seems like it's a sham. What we're really doing is we're giving Treasury a chance to hammer the civil society. There's a critique of civil society, really, in what they say. Right, in some respects, yes, in some respects. And so it must be. That's what your job. If you're not doing it, then I must report you to the minister. That's your job. So what you're complaining about, you're doing your job very well, I might add, even if one disagrees with some of the things you say. And so we should disagree, because if you were sitting here, Momo, you would say exactly the same things I'm saying. If I'm sitting there, I hope I wouldn't be saying what you're saying. Otherwise, I can't be in the Communist Party. Right? But that's a separate issue. Now, the thing is, colleagues, let's manage the time properly. I'm a bit worried. Let me suggest my own view, right? Let you and the majority decide. The quality of what you are hearing is very good. We've never had a difficult... Somebody thought now saying it's a challenging budget, right? He thought I'm trying to like dilute how bad a budget... No, that's not what I meant. I mean, it's challenging to process because of the VAT increase for the first time. But he's right to misinterpret me. That is democratic right. No, the thing is, how are we going to manage the time? That's all I want to know. So, colleagues, there's a way out. We can give you another half an hour. That will take us... If Tubby doesn't keep interrupting, needless to say, that will take us to 22. But then we have to give them close to 45 minutes to reply. How many of you here from civil society? Four entities, right? So not all four of you, but each of you can get 10 to 12 minutes, right? Then they will reply, but then the members will speak, then we will engage. If Tali behaves, we can have half an hour there. Then, and then what we're going to do is throw it back to Treasury to reply and for you to say something. No, you must reply. Treasury says something. So I would say tentatively we can finish at 12:30. Yeah, sure, non-process. Yeah.
You know, Chad, I'm happy that you're saying this, but let me tell you the limitation if we don't have adequate engagement, especially counter-engagement on statements that have been put in the public discourse. It leaves a particular impression. For instance, you see there's an argument that VAT is regressive, and if the response time to that and the platform to respond to that is not adequate, where people who have made that claim are not here to respond back or to be re-engaged so that the public is clarified, it's the limitation. So we need to look at how we engage and the time frames that we deal with, because it creates a public perception, and that public perception leads to certain activities in society. So I'm not saying anything, but I'm saying let's look at it, how we do it. Once an issue of this nature, of this magnitude, especially when we're dealing with structural changes that are being contested, highly contested. So I leave it to you, because if we don't pay, people can rise on their own impression, because they've not been clarified in totality. So
I'm echoing exactly what we are saying. You see, what I would suggest, colleagues, is let them speak, just civil society respond so we get both sides. Right? Then we come in. One of the things we are saying, I'm very interested personally to hear what they critique the executive. Then we have a discussion, having a both sides. And then we give Treasury a last slide. If that's the way we've done it before.
Yeah.
But all I'm pleading for is at least people stay till 12:30, and if need be, 1 o'clock. And Sunny, you are right. What I think we should do next year, and we can do it next year, is to have a whole day sitting, and not on a Friday, because members are going to Polokwane and so on, and Bombela and so on, they're not fair. They have to go through Joburg, many of them, and so on. Yeah, Mr. Lisi, you want to say on process?
Well, I don't undermine the stakeholders that are here, but the ones that make very, very penetrating issues are not necessarily here.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's the thing.
Yeah. Now, I don't know why you're insulting those on here, but it's your point. I'm teasing you, my sister.
Honourable Lisi, and then I'll go on again.
Just a quick one, Mr. Chairman. Certainly I'm happy to stay, and that's not a problem. I'm a little bit concerned about the religious angle at 12 o'clock, and it's kind of cut a certain religious people out of it.
That's a reality we have to face. Ongo Monikedi?
Yeah. Chair, I'm just concerned about us discussing the issue of process again and again. By doing that, we are actually eating into the time that we should be spending listening to the National Treasury and later civil society. My opinion really is that why don't we give them the chance, they speak, and towards 12 o'clock or whatever, if there are still have time constraints, we then discuss and rearrange. So for now, I appeal that we don't discuss the matter of the process anymore. We give them the chance to present.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Certainly, we are prepared to stay as long as required for this discussion. And I mean, we are trying to respond to a wide range of inputs from civil society, from business, from labour. We don't see this as a response, as a specific response. We'd like to have a broad, general discussion of all the role players. So I think I'll just complete on this slide, just to say, so this, there's been increasing pressure on the public finances. We witness it in the rising debt to GDP ratio, and we also witness it in the rising debt service costs. And debt service costs, which I'll show you in a moment, have increased substantially and are now going to account for almost 180 billion rands worth of our tax revenue in 2018-19. So, and this increase is mostly, as I said, it's about lower than expected GDP growth, but it's also about the decisions we made, particularly around the wage bill, and I'll come to that in a moment. So one of the questions that was put forward is, you know, why do you think debt is actually going to stabilize this time? Because over the past 4 years, we've typically seen the debt to GDP ratio being revised up each time we present a budget. And we are very clear on this budget. In fact, we try to bring it to the foreground of the entire book in each chapter. There are major risks. This budget represents one step, in our view, in the right direction, but the risks are significant. The risks to growth are significant. The risks from the state and company sector are significant. So we're not out of the woods, and we need to reiterate that. This is the first step in getting the public finances back to where we need to be over the medium to long term. And the way we're going to do it, as this graph shows, there are two lines on this graph. The one is the red line, which is spending as a share of GDP, main budget, non-interest spending. That's the red line. And again, just to point out that spending increased rapidly in the mid-2000s from around 22% of GDP to 26% of GDP by 2009-10. And since then, with the introduction of the expenditure ceiling, amongst other things, we've basically seen spending stabilize as a share of GDP. So on the other side, the black line shows revenue, and revenue fell very sharply at the time of the global financial crisis, which obviously fed through to a recession in South Africa in 2009-10. And since then, it's been a story of revenue slowly recovering over time and boosted by fairly significant increases in taxes. And almost all of those increases, or the vast majority, have fallen on personal income tax. And as you can see, the goal of the fiscal framework is to bring those two lines together. Because when those two lines come together and you start running surpluses, main budget primary surpluses, that's when debt starts to stabilize and come down as a share of GDP. That's when debt service costs start to come down. And that's when more space is made available in the budget for other expenditure items. So yes, it's a tough budget. There have been big trade-offs and decisions taken. And the main thing is to stabilize the finances and start rebuilding fiscal space. I've already mentioned this, but I'd just like to point out, because this came up a few times in the hearings, this is also from the budget review. It just shows that if you look at the line that's entitled total, it'll show you that in next year we anticipate spending 180 billion on debt service costs. These are the interest repayments on the debt that we already have. And that grows to about 213 billion by 2020-21. And as a share of revenue, that's the bottom line, as a share of revenue, it grows from about 13.6% of total revenue to around 13.9%. So the longer that debt continues to grow as a share of GDP, the more that we're going to be spending on repaying that debt, and more of our revenue is going towards that. And this, by the way, this increase has been growing over a long period of time, and we think it's very important that we stabilize this and reduce the rate at which debt service costs eat up more and more of our tax revenues. I've mentioned this before. On the next slide, the risks are significant. The growth outlook, ESCOM, and many other entities are in dire financial straits at the moment. We'll talk a little bit about the public service wage bill outlook, but of course there's a wage negotiation on at the moment. Treasury has said in the budget review, our view is that a CPI increase in cost of living adjustments is, given the current headcount numbers, is approximately what can be managed within the current compensation ceiling. There's uncertainty around the implementation costs of fee-free higher education. This was a discussion. There are many uncertainties there, but I can just point you to one. For example, we are uncertain on what the income distribution of students is, and of course, exactly how many students there are below this 350,000 rand cutoff. At the moment, of course, it's easier to identify the poor students in the NSFAS system, but when it comes to lower middle income, up to 350,000, that is more difficult. So there's even uncertainty, for example, around how many students will be affected by this change, and other uncertainties which we can discuss. We've already mentioned the sub-investment downgrade and the implications. Those are the economic outlook scenarios that I presented earlier. And lastly, I'm going to talk about this a bit. It's also the deteriorating financial position of the Road Accident Fund. And the reason why I bring this up is because one area of concern is on the increases in the fuel levies. And the fuel levies go up by a total of 51 cents in 2018-19, but of that amount, 52 cents, but of that amount, 50 cents is going towards the Road Accident Fund, not to general revenues. And I'll explain in a moment why that is. Okay, so there were several questions around the expenditure changes, which have been very significant, the adjustments, and some concerns around expenditure cuts and so on, and we're going to talk a little bit about those now. But just to give you the headline numbers again, so the MTBPS spending baselines were reduced, and this is a three-year number, just for clarity. This is the total three-year number from 2018-19, 19-20, and 2020-21. So over the next 3 years in total, those baselines have been reduced by 85 billion. It's about 25 to 30 billion per year. Then an allocation has been set aside for fee-free higher education of 57 billion over the next 3 years. An additional 10 billion was set aside for the contingency reserve, because one of the big changes that happened, in fact, one of the only major changes, excuse me, I'm speaking too quickly, okay, I'll slow down. It is there, I know, we are trying to get through a lot of information, but let me slow down a bit on the spending reallocation. 10 billion then is set aside for the contingency reserve. At the time of the MTBPS, the contingency reserve was revised down quite substantially in order to close the deficit somewhat. But our view is, given the major risks around the economic outlook, state-owned companies and other spending pressures, we need to revise up those contingencies somewhat, and that's what we've done. There's 4.2 billion rand for national health insurance over the next 3 years, and of course a 2.6 billion rand addition to the current baseline of social grants were slightly higher than inflation increases to social grants. Now, there was a lot of discussion, is that sufficient? Maybe just to explain the logic. We think that without the VAT increase, CPI inflation would likely have come in well below 5%, more or less in line with other estimates, for example, done by the South African Reserve Bank. With the VAT increase, we are projecting inflation of 5.5% next year, and then the increases on social grants give a bit more in addition to that. We're not suggesting that this is the be-all and end-all. It is part of our efforts to cushion the impact of this increase on the poorest members of society. In addition to that, we set aside a provisional allocation for drought relief, assistance to the water sector and public infrastructure projects. That's for the current year that's about to start, 2018-19. And again, we think that's because of the severity of the droughts in several provinces, and we are basically saying, as Treasury, we are providing some space for immediate assistance over the coming year. And if you take all of this into account, and I think this maybe was part of the confusion, if you take all of this into account, then spending ceilings come down marginally over the next 3 years. But in broad terms, spending is stable at around 26.4% of GDP over the medium term. This is main budget spending. Now, I'm going to talk a bit about the reductions, because the reductions are very significant for all the other departments besides the Department of Post-School Education and Training. And there was a lot of concern about exactly what had informed these cuts, and I've now laid it out in the slide as clearly as we can. So the first point to make is that the reductions fell mostly on national government, and that was because we wanted to ensure that national government absorbs most of it and protects the frontline services of provincial and local governments. The major changes were that large programs of more than a billion rand were reduced in 1819, but all health and education related programs were excluded. There was also a 2% across the board reduction on administrative programs of national and provincial departments. There was a 5% reduction on transfers to all public entities receiving more than 300 million rand in 2018-19. And research councils, health entities, and others in dire financial distress were excluded from these reductions. On conditional grants, and these are the grants that are given to subnational government, it was a 5% reduction on all provincial and local conditional grants except for social, except for health and social development grants. And in some instances, the reductions were larger on slow spending grants. The details can be found in the introductory chapter of the Estimates of National Expenditure, in which we go into a line-by-line explanation of how the different functions are influenced by these changes. Once all of the changes are made, allocations are put towards higher education, and the reductions have been taken into account. This is what the spending outlook is, and our view is that the spending remains highly progressive, it remains targeted at constitutional imperatives. The major spending item there remains basic education, around 15% of the budget, social protection, around 12% of the budget, health, 12% of the budget, over 200 billion, community development, around 196 billion, and peace and security, around 200 billion, and economic development, around 200 billion. So this is the overarching breakdown of spending in 2018-19, and we note again that debt service costs are often taking up a larger and larger share of total spending, and of course post-school education and training gets a large increase. Okay, I've been asked to move a bit faster.
I think the point is two-thirds of this budget is allocated to functions, you know, for social type services, social rights, education, healthcare, social security, housing. I think that's an important point to make.
So, as I've already mentioned, our view is the budget remains progressive. We have, for example, the study that was undertaken in 2015, which shows that if you look at the top 10% of the income distribution, in other words, those on the far right of this graph, approximately 71% of taxes are collected from the top 10% of households, while receiving approximately 6% of social spending. At the bottom end of the income distribution, the bottom 50% of households that pay roughly 4% of total taxes and receive approximately 60% of total social spending. Now, if we look at the most recent budget, to reiterate, the budget has reduced large programs, administration, transfers to public entities, and conditional grants. But it is also reallocating towards fee-free higher education, higher contingency reserves, national health insurance, drought relief and other related matters, and higher social class. And if one then takes us all into account, you have the graph there on the right, which shows how quickly the different areas of spending are going to grow over the medium term. And you can see that by far and away the fastest growing area of spending is now post-school education and training. Concerningly for us, the second on the list are debt service costs that are growing at about 9.4% per year on average, followed by social protection, health, economic development, and community development. And the area of spending that is growing the slowest is general public services, which is around administration departments, including ourselves, National Treasury. So the budget continues to grow the elements of the budget that are targeted at social spending and education. Now, what are the implications of the reduction for the division of revenue? I'd just like to make four points. We know that the reductions on infrastructure are going to result in some delays in infrastructure rollout, and we make that very clear in the book, and we are clear that these are significant changes that will have to be carefully managed. Having said that, the services have been protected, including grants funding for school meals, bus subsidies, and medicines. The local equitable share, and the local equitable share is the element that covers services like the free basic services and so on, continues to grow at around 10% per annum for local level and 7% per annum for provincial government over the next 3 years. And in total, the reductions that we've just discussed bring down the provincial allocation by about 1% over the next 3 years and local government by around 3.5% over the next 3 years. And the table on the right just gives you a broad summary of how nationally raised revenues divided between national, provincial, and local government. Around 48% of nationally raised revenue goes to national government, 43% to provincial government, and around 9% to local government. Okay, I realize that we are covering a lot of ground here, but we still need to get to discussions on the specific tax measures. This slide also makes the point that
I know you're going to complain, but you have to manage this properly. Do you know, did you just fall under appropriation?
Yes.
Right, so I know he's concerned your committee, but you're going to need that. Let's focus more on what falls on fiscal framework here.
Okay.
Yeah.
March, we get this briefing on the division of revenue.
Okay. Right, okay. So we're going to... Okay, so if we look at the distribution of spending by economic classification, and this was the point that Mama made earlier, this is now on slide 20, we can see that compensation of employees remains the largest area of spending, and more concerning for us is the information found on slide 19, which is the compensation as a share of total expenditure. So on slide 19, we have a table that shows that compensation as a share of total spending, particularly in labor-intensive industries, has increased. The labor-intensive departments have increased dramatically over the past 8 years or so. And we can see, for example, that in the Department of Defense, spending on compensation has gone from 38% of the budget in 2008-09 to around 57% of the budget in 2016-17.
Okay, the most dramatic, I don't know why it's not there, is education. If you look at it, it would be 85 to 95% spending on specifically for personnel. I mean, it is a personnel intensive department, but the point is how much of a share should it be, should non personnel be. Okay, shall we just move on? I think we've done, let's just move on to the next one now.
Before we move to tax, just one more point. The Road Accident Fund, of the 52% per litre increase in fuel levies, which we are now showing to you on slide 21, 30% goes to the Road Accident Fund. 30 cents goes towards the Road Accident Fund. And basically what this 30 cents is doing is stabilizing their short-term liabilities. In other words, claims finalized but not yet paid. And it doesn't even begin to address the massive actuarial liability, which is projected to grow from 260 billion rand in 2018-19 to around 355 billion rand in 2020-21.
I understand the argument of our children. Yes. You see, you want us only focus on structural changes that you made, and I will quantify. So that the rest of issues that will relate to the division of the new and appropriation should be dealt with, and I'm sure we are in the immediate are going to speak to the MTSM, the MTSM. So maybe if you come to the features of text, then it relates to them. So that
But Chair, I think on this one, what we're trying to show is within the system at national, there are big surpluses at the UIF and compensation fund. There's a massive deficit in the road accident fund. Okay. You can't move funds from one to the other to pay. That's not allowed. By law. But this is a growing problem that needs to be dealt with. Huge risk. But maybe let's leave it at that and maybe let's go on to the text. I think the issue was, and again we did raise it, though I know what you want to say. We did raise it in the when we responded on Wednesday, that there is a bill that's stuck in the transport committee, and the sooner that's passed it begins to deal. Yeah. Yeah, so the fuel levy went up so much because to meet the deficit.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we say. Yeah. That's what you want to say. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. So, Chair, let's just move. Chris, you want to start with the text? Let's move down fast. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I'll try to be very quick. I think on the fuel levy, I mean, it should also be noted that an inflationary increase in the fuel levy would have been a 17 cents per litre increase. We increased the general fuel levy by 22 cents per litre. So we increased it by 5 cents more than inflation. So there would have been a big, rather large increase in the general fuel levy anyway. It's an inflationary increase. The big change is really because of this RAF, this very large RAF deficit, which then led to a 50 cent per litre increase, which we needed almost to do just to keep the RAF afloat. So that's the point that we're trying to make on the fuel levy. I mean, every year going forward, even if we weren't going to change anything, inflationary increases in the general fuel levy would be around 17, 18 cents per litre, and we did 22 cents. The first point just is on the tax system as a whole. So there's a paper by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Tax by Design, and it talks about what ideal tax system do we want. And it's quite important just because it says taxes should be structured to meet overall spending needs and earmarking should be avoided. We've just spoken about the problems with earmarking. Not all taxes are needed to address all objectives. And not all taxes need to be progressive as long as the overall system is. So their whole point of the system is that you need to look at the tax system as a whole and say which taxes can you use for progressivity, which taxes do you need to be efficient. So generally the right tool for achieving distributional objectives are direct personal taxes and direct benefits and spending to individuals. So those are the ones we try and use to make our whole tax system progressive.
Just so that Chris is not misunderstood, and we made the point on Wednesday as well, if you take your sin taxes, they tend to be regressive, but they're still important to have because you want to discourage smoking and so on. But the big taxes that matter tend to be progressive. That's what we
Thanks.
You need to look at the entire system.
Okay, so I'll try and answer some direct questions. So a lot of the first presenters on Wednesday said we're one of the highest tax countries in the world, and they used some statistics. But as Mama mentioned earlier, it excludes social security contributions, it excludes some state taxes. So a much better measure for us is just the OECD overall tax to GDP ratio. You can see from the chart in 23, we are not one of the highest tax countries in the world. We'd like to just repeat that point. But as members in these committees have in previous years asked us, what about the spending side? Because in some of the countries they get much, perhaps more benefits from the spending that they get. So this also isn't an ideal measure, but it certainly does show that we're not one of the most taxed in the world. The next slide on 24, there was some comment that we don't provide enough information in the budget and that we don't provide distributional analysis of our tax proposals. This table we publish every year, and it's a distributional analysis of our changes to the personal income tax system. You can see in that little red square is a little bit out in the wrong way, but on column 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, income tax relief, we show the changes to our personal income tax system and what they do, how they affect each income on the different levels of the income distribution. The point here is that the personal income tax system is very progressive, and this is where we have the most progressive part of our tax system. The top 50% of our personal income tax is paid by 500,000 people. So you can look at that bottom. And then about 110,000 earn above 1.5 million. So the budget 2018, a lot of calls will say, why didn't we increase PIT? We did increase PIT by quite a lot. I mean, we tried to raise about 6.8 billion from this, partly through 0% inflation relief for the top four income tax brackets, which makes the system more progressive. And you can see that in the results of the table. The next chart.
Just to point out, but the dilemma we also face is if you want to raise more money from PIT, it's in the middle that, you know, that you have a large numbers paying and larger, in total large amounts. If you look at the 350,000 to 500,000, they would raise 15% of taxable income, okay, and similarly. So, and the problem is the very rich people who deserve to be paying more are very small, and therefore the revenue is actually very little. That's the kind of dilemma we face. So that's why when you put it up from 42% to 45%, the top bracket, we only estimated at 4, and we've got less than that.
Yeah, we got it in the later slide. So, I mean, the revenue increases, this next chart on slide 25 is just showing the different proportions. So from 2010 or so, we've been gradually increasing personal income taxes. So a lot of that has been through policy measures that we've used to try and get additional revenue. If you look at the next slide, slide 26, so what have we done over the past 4 or 5 years? We had a 1% increase in 2014-15 across all the brackets except for the bottom bracket to keep the tax-free threshold the same. In 2016-17, we had a 4 percentage point increase in the top bracket from 41% to 45%. And then in previous years, we've given very little relief for inflation. So the same way we spoke about the fuel levy, every year we'll give inflation relief. In previous years, we've given very little relief. 3.5% in 2013-14, 1.8% in 2016-17, 1% in 2017-18. So we have been trying to generate a lot more revenue from this. So over these years, people will pay more. If you look at an individual earning 350,000 now, if we had increased the brackets and the rebate by inflation over the last 5 years, he would be paying 6,200 less. So in effect, he's saying someone on 350,000 is paying 6,200 rand more now than if we had just changed the brackets, the tables with inflation from 5 years ago. An individual who's earning 2 million is paying about 50,000 rand more now. So they are saying we have increased the personal income tax take. And we have made progressive changes over this period. We moved from a medical tax deduction, which gives a deduction at the marginal rate for everybody, which is not as progressive, to a medical tax credit. So regardless of your level of income, we give you the same amount of money as a subsidy for your medical tax contribution. We did a chart and a table and a box in the medium-term budget policy statement that shows that 56% of the medical tax credit goes to households or individuals who earn below 300,000. So we think it makes it a much more progressive system. We've limited the deduction for retirement fund contributions to 350,000, so that wealthy individuals can't take too much advantage. And we have increased the effective capital gains tax rate from about 10% to 18% over the last 5 years. The OECD average on that is about 17%. And people must remember with this effective capital gains tax rate that it takes into account the impact of inflation. There was a long paper that we published on our website that was done in 2001 which talks about, because we're a higher inflation-free environment, this is so that you're not taxing inflationary gains. That's why it was slightly lower, lower than the income tax rate. On the next page, this is what Momo was talking about. I'll deal with this first bullet last. The top tax base is small. There's about 110,000 people who earn about who have taxable income about 1.5 million. So when we increase to 45%, we expected to make about 4.4 billion. It looks as if we're going to be making a bit less than that. Now, when you're in a budget, we need to make 36 billion in order to get the numbers correct, in order for the fiscal framework to work, in order for us to stabilize debt. We can't only tax the very wealthy. We're not going to get enough money. So if we had increased the rate, let's say, to 50%, and we looked at all... So we looked at all these options. So we looked at these options. If we increased it to 50%, how much would it bring? It might bring in about 5 billion. But we're not quite sure, because there are big behavioral impacts from this group. They can afford tax advisors. They can probably afford to, you know, look at structures to avoid the tax. They can afford to perhaps move. These people are mobile. And the last increase doesn't look as if it made us as much as we thought it would. So it's not a certain source of revenue, and you know, we were worried about it. It also does have a real impact on work efforts and economic activity. And that's what a lot of the research that we put down does show. The next point is just that when we tried to raise PRT revenues this year, we tried to raise around, I think, about 18 billion. And it looks as if we're going to be about 21.1 billion short on that. So we tried to raise a whole lot of money, and now it's our biggest underperforming personal tax revenue category. The same thing for last year. Last year we tried to raise a lot of money from personal income taxes, and again we were about 16 billion short on personal income taxes last year. So we keep underperforming on our personal income taxes. It's coming under a lot of pressure. So to raise the next slide of 28, this is just to give the committee to show the type of options that we looked at to raise the same amount of money. So if we needed to raise 22.9 billion on top of the 6.81 billion, because we're already raising 6.81 billion on personal income taxes, so you need to raise around 30. You need to do a 1 percentage point increase in all the brackets, including the bottom bracket, which we've never touched before. And if you increase the bottom bracket, that means your tax-free threshold goes down. So instead of your tax-free threshold being 78,000, it'll now drop to 74,000. So people will start paying tax at 74,000 instead of 78. And it'll increase the top rate to 46%. Or we could have had no change in any of the brackets and rebates and kept the tax-free threshold at 75,000 and had a 1 percentage point increase in the next four brackets and a 2 percentage point increase in the top two brackets. Or you could have done no change and you've had a 3 percentage point increase in the top three brackets, increasing the top rate to 48. These are the types of, obviously, the simulation. I just wanted to give the committee a flavor for all the different scenarios we look at. On page 29, so now what about corporate income taxes? Why can't we raise corporate income taxes? So now, we want to tax capital owners more. And a lot of that, who are capital owners? I mean, they are individuals. So, and we've done that through increasing the top rate. Last year, we increased the dividends withholding tax rate from 15% to 20%, which was a very big increase and came under a lot of pressure. And those are the shareholders when they get distributions from the corporate. But the corporate income tax rate is one of the main aspects that investors consider to invest in our country. And it's one of the main aspects they look at when they make investment decisions. So with the 28% rate that we haven't changed for a very long time, we are slowly becoming an outlier. Everybody else is reducing their rates. So the global trend is down. UK is now at 18%, Netherlands and US at 21%, China 25%, Russia 15%. And the problem is, the bigger the gap, the bigger the incentive and the bigger the impact of base erosion and profit shifting. There are about 40% of our revenue is generated by SA subsidiaries of foreign multinational enterprises. So now, if you have a foreign multinational, and our rate is quite high, their incentive to try and shift profits offshore to these lower tax jurisdictions is very large. You can be in the UK, and you can try and shift your profits from South Africa to the UK, and you will pay less tax as a global multinational enterprise. And this is what we need to try and do. So we're trying to counter it with proposals on base erosion and profit shifting, but it's difficult, it's complicated. You need specialized skills within the revenue authority to then audit and find these things. Legislation alone isn't going to do enough. So The other point Mama made earlier is we try to tax the owners of capital through dividends, withholding tax, higher capital gains tax rates, and higher personal income tax rates. But also, will they bear the full brunt if you have a corporate income tax rate? And they won't. There's a lot of mixed literature, there's mixed literature on everything, that shows that a lot of it isn't passed on to the shareholders. Some of it can be passed on to employees, some of it's passed on through higher prices that go to consumers. So again, it's not a clear-cut argument. There was just one study, it's just one of many, that showed that the vast majority of the impact actually fell on the employees of retail industries within Canada. So slide 30 is just trying to show you we're three quarters of the way across on the left in the dotted one. The black dots are what the corporate income tax rate was in the year 2000. The grey bars are what the corporate income tax rate was in 2015. So you can see a bunch of other countries, all those black dots are a lot higher. They've all been reducing their corporate income tax rates over time. We've hardly changed ours, which is why everybody else is now going below it. And this includes US, UK, etc. And then if you look at the next slide, this is just to show you 31. So people think the corporates don't pay tax. Our corporate income tax as a share of GDP is much higher than others. And this is OECD, you know, we think this is a reasonable benchmark to look at. It's much higher than the OECD average, much higher than the African average. So corporates are paying their taxes. Are they paying enough? I mean, that's something that you can debate, and we want to look at it as well in terms of broadening the base, are there too many incentives, allowances, etc. But those are things you can do quickly. So the next few slides are just on the economic impact. So a lot of questions are raised on, well, what is the economic impact of the different taxes? So OECD did a tax and economic growth study in 2010, and it came out, I'll just read the one bold section in the middle. Corporate income taxes are the most powerful type of tax for economic growth, followed by personal income taxes and then consumption taxes, with recurrent taxes on immovable property being the least harmful. Okay, so that's just one study. If you go to the next one, it's the Bureau of Economic Research. They find, in the case of the VAT increase, the most immediate result would be a hike in inflation. And it also raises the cost of imported goods and weighs on import volume growth, which limits the adverse GDP impact stemming from a VAT hike. And they support a general increase in the VAT rate. Then the Data Tax Committee on the next slide, again, I'll just read the bold part. While there would be a negative impact on real GDP and employment, particularly in the short term, the impact of a VAT increase on these two variables would be less severe than that of a rise in CIT or CIT. And then I've got an annex right at the end, there's two slides, we won't go through it now, but just on all the different research that we've looked at in terms of what is the differential impact on VAT versus PIT and versus CIT. The OECD came under a lot of pressure from the tax and economic growth study, the first one we spoke about, because it doesn't consider distributional impact enough, which is the whole point of this. So they've done another study called tax and inclusive growth. And again, that study finds that when you look at it over a lifetime, that VAT isn't as regressive and that it should be increased to improve economic growth. So this comes to the final point. So just try to build up and say, well, why are we increasing the VAT rate? I mean, we'd much rather not increase taxes. We correct. There was a commentator on Wednesday said, this is showing that truly agrees that there will be a detrimental impact on growth. We completely agree any taxes will have a detrimental impact on growth. But the point here is which will have the least detrimental. I think everybody agrees that growth is what you need to sort out the issues. Growth is what you need to get higher revenue. Growth is what you need to create more employment. Growth is what you need to try and sort out our fiscal framework. Now, all the research that we do shows that VAT will have the least detrimental impact on growth. And not only that, the problem we have with trying to increase these other taxes for this bank issue, A, we've been trying to do it on the PIT side, but we haven't got enough of those revenues. That revenue is not coming in. The CIT side as well, what will happen? Will we get enough of that CIT revenue? The VAT increase is a certain source of revenue. We're much more likely to get this revenue for our forecast to be okay than the other taxes. If we increase PIT by a huge amount, again, this year, and it didn't realize, we would be in this exact same position next year. We would have to make more increases, we would be struggling to get the fiscal framework correct again. So it's a certain source of revenue. Just the next slide, I mean, we did get calls and we didn't have a distributional impact. This is just a slide to show that we have done work, tried to do work on the distributional impact. The big point to note from here, yes, the majority is paid by for gas, and we weren't trying to be disingenuous with that one stat about, you know, X amount of 80% is paid by the top 30, which is just a truism. The point here is that even the bottom deciles do pay VAT. If you increase personal income tax, those bottom deciles won't pay any increases in tax. Okay, but here they will pay, and we were clear about that in the budget, that all the living costs of all households will increase. So just quickly on the progressivity, the next slide, slide 37. In our view, we didn't talk about progressivity and regressivity in the budget review because the evidence is mixed in our view. And if you look at earlier research, this table just shows, so what does regressivity or progressivity mean? Is the tax as a proportion of income, does it get higher or lower as you have higher income? So this table shows that in the second column, those people earning 7,000 Rand had about a 7.6% of the income went to VAT, whereas those people earning 266,000 had about a 4.3% of the income went to VAT. So that shows it's clearly regressive. Again, this was early research from 1993. So it did show that VAT was regressive, but it did say that VAT burden is significantly reduced by zero rating. If you go to the
just to make the point though, when VAT was first introduced, there were no social grants. Come, obviously, 94, VAT still stays the same, but it's more the social grants and so on. So your kind of regressivity of the and progressivity of the system actually changes if you take that and expenditure together. Sorry.
The next slide is just on, we've seen this chart, we've just put it a bit differently. Sorry, the source is wrong on the bottom. This is the World Bank 2015 paper. You've seen a chart that added, they had the, it had VAT and excise and fuel all together. We've just broken it up. So the highest bar is VAT, the red bar. And you can see that at the bottom decile, it's around 9 or something percent. At the very top decile, it's closer to 12. So this is the sort of provocative research should say that VAT is mildly progressive. Okay. They also say that without zero rating it would be regressive, but because of the zero rating it becomes mildly progressive. Now, we are just trying to say that it is a little bit technical and people are fixating on this regressive versus progressive point, but it is broadly proportional, in fact, we can see by that chart. But the main point is that lower income households will pay more, and we're not hiding away from that fact. But, you know, the question is, will they be better off if we're in an environment where growth increases dramatically, we get the revenue that we need, and employment starts increasing? If you have lower yields on your debt, then you pay less on debt service interest costs, which we saw from chart before, and you have more money for social expenditure programs. If the currency is strengthening, you know, fuel prices would go down, food prices would go down, would they be better off from that point of view? So the overall economic impact of sorting out the fiscal framework could have much larger benefits and could outweigh these increases in costs. Okay, I'd like to just hand over to Impor to carry on with the rest of the section.
Good morning, honorable members. Just to look at the issue that has been raised with regards to having a luxury debt in the system, the discussion on not only about maybe certain foods that are consumed by high-income individuals who have a luxury debt. The Marco Commission in 1987 looked at the issue of the luxury debt or having a multiple rate. And then the conclusion there was that having a multiple rate system is the most faithful and inefficient way to deal with it, which is also a decision. And I think Chris also mentioned the issue earlier with regards to the principles around tax design. Mm-hmm. That basically the tax instrument cannot be everything to deal with this issue around inflation and bullshit. We have personal income tax or income taxes that deal with distributional issues. To look at consumption taxes to deal with distribution issues becomes a little bit difficult, and also whether that those instruments are necessarily tailored for that purpose. And there's plenty of literature that shows that consumption taxes are not tailored to deal with redistributional issues. And also, that was also looked at by the Health Commission in 1994, basically to look at the disadvantage of multiple VAT rates. That basically it outweighs the distributive gain to achieve. And also, the pronouncement were made by the Health Commission in their report to look at the issue about the multiple rates. That basically it will apply to a small proportion of total consumption and won't necessarily deal with the issue of redistribution. And then again, the issue around the administration that helps them to accompany such a system where you have multiple rates. Because then again, you get into the issues around which products should be included in that and all of that. And then you always sort of like get great ideas around that and the administration around that, the cost related to that. Next slide. Basically, then to say the issue around having a multiple rate system cannot be divorced from what is currently there in the system in terms of the ad valorem, because ad valorem exercise applies to luxury goods. Now, the committee also had a look at it to say instead of having this multiple rate system. We have a tool currently in the system, which is the ad valorem that can be maybe tailored to look at into that. And what we have done also in terms of the 2018 budget was to look at how then we can make increases to those ad valorem sites to deal with the issue, because it focuses on luxury items. How can then we increase progressivity or get more revenue from that sector? So we increased the current rate from 7% to 9%, and also we increased the maximum cap on motor vehicles from 25% to 30%. With this motor vehicles, it has a progressive structure in terms of calculating the ad valorem, and it was kept at 25%. Now we have increased that to 30%. And we also made a proposal around the taxation of the smart home. That we're thinking about having sort of like a similar structure in terms of having the progressive tax structure for dealing with smart home.
And you in effect have multiple rates currently to some extent. That's what we mean.
And then basically, when we look at the sort of changes that you have proposed, we estimate that we'll get a billion from that. Because again, if you are dealing with a defined set of goods, and which is relatively small. Now, when we look at sort of the benefits of low zero rating, currently we have the 19 food items. I mean, there's an issue that has been raised in terms of whether those 19 food items are well targeted, and also looking at the review of that basket. And literature that has been done on this issue shows that not all the products that are in the basket necessarily are well targeted or benefit the school. So it is one of the things that basically just indicates that basically trying to deal with redistributional issues through the tax system can be quite inefficient in terms of dealing with those issues. Now, the issue again has been raised, I think, by the Peter Money Bank Agency around sort of like the budget doesn't sort of like the suit or basically it's not tailored to what the poor consume currently. And there's a process that has been talked about looking at, you know, maybe reconfiguration or looking at instances that they talk about additional products being included there. But I think what is important is maybe just to highlight about the issue around it cannot just be sort of like an addition to the 19 food items. If already in the current system there are products that have been identified to say they don't benefit or they are not well targeted. So I think maybe if anything, the issue around the 19 food basket needs to be reconsidered in this system. And then again, the important thing also would be to the costing of those zero ratings to make sure that even distributionally, in terms of the consumption, are those products that are now going to be included or we thought about in terms of including, are those products, will they be well targeted? And also again, based on what is the cost in terms of the benefit that will be accruing to high income households, these are the relief that you are seeking to provide to lower income households. And also we're looking at that there should be some almost like an independent
expectation. Yeah, I think, look, what we are saying, and I think what Paul is saying, obviously, that, and it's not just VAT, I should say. VAT generally is a blunt instrument to reach any group, okay? But having said that, we clearly are open to reviewing the current zero-rated products and increasing the list. And to do that, I think what we would suggest is to do it in some sort of independent way. We think, for example, we haven't worked out the exact mechanisms, but we say, could we, for example, ask the Davis Tax Committee to get a panel of experts to look at this, have hearings, and then provide a report. It's not necessarily they're also going to NGOs and whatever. So we haven't firmed this up. Yesterday's cabinet meeting also talked about some ministerial committee, so we could bring these processes together, but get that expert committee and get academics and others who have worked on poor households look at what they actually eat compared to what was there 20 years ago. So we think that, you know, through that, so we're not saying we'll directly convene, but in some way we'll convene a panel of independent experts to investigate the potential for expansion of review of zero rated. And I think we'll also ask them to look at some of the current programs. I mean, my favorite one, which is always a school feeding scheme, okay? I don't know why it's not gone beyond primary school nutrition. I think we should look at how that could reach poor students, sort out all the tenuring problems around it. I think it's a program that should be well, that can be well targeted if you do it through the schooling system. And I always say, well, the food must be there at 7 o'clock in the morning, not at 10 or 12 or so, okay? The other, so they would certainly then have hearings, and separate from that, the Treasury itself will be meeting with agencies. We do our own research. I think we hear, whoever has submitted and others who don't, we will continue to engage with them to look at their research, also just to help to see that capacity. So, Chair, I think just to conclude, and just in terms of the papers, if we get to the last slide, and I think there's a whole lot of other papers. We've given members a set, you should have it, of some of the papers which you could go through on the studies that we referred to. But I guess you want to just start doing the conclusion.
Okay. So I we've covered so much ground, and in fact, as Chris has mentioned, there are even additional readings at the back on the equity and growth implications of different tax decisions. But to just conclude, I mean, what the budget is trying to do is close a big funding gap while making space for big new spending commitments. And that, those two things had to happen simultaneously. We've done that through a combination of major spending adjustments and tax increases. And we think that these major interventions are necessary at this time to reverse the trend that was apparent at the NTBPS, an unsustainable fiscal trend that became apparent at the time of the NTBPS, and that without these adjustments, we would be heading for scenario 2 or scenario 3, which means lower growth, higher interest rates, higher inflation, lower employment, and increased poverty. And an absolute keystone of a functioning and faster-growing economy are public finances that are on a sure footing and are sustainable over the medium to long term. And that is the key of this entire budget. And we are aware that the risks are large, that's why we've got bigger contingency reserves, but we've tried to address some of those risks. We've tried to provide space in the budget for some of those risks. We know we're not out of the woods, but this is the first step in getting the public finances onto the right track. And then just to close by saying, we take transparency seriously. We have recently been rated number one with New Zealand, but I would also just like, I still feel that it's quite difficult for some individuals to understand where this information is. So the first point is the budget review is available at the first link here, but it's not just the budget review. We're at pains to publish all the data that appears in the budget review in Excel format together with the graphs. You can replicate the graphs, you can look at the tables in detail, as well as all the documentation. We've got a new budget portal, which is the second link here, and that budget portal, if you have a look at it, you'll see we've tried to again simplify the budget documents into simple graphics so you can look at what each department is spending on different functions and so on. And lastly, if you're interested in local government finances, we again have a separate website dedicated exclusively to simplifying local government finances called Municipal Money. Thank you, Chair. I know we've bombarded you with information, but it was a complex and difficult budget, and we've tried to explain as best we can. Thank you.
Excellent work. Thank you very much. This is our homework for the weekend and for the debate. Pardon? Well, me too. I'm chairing two committees. Now we're going to our stakeholders. I'm going to give you 7 minutes each to engage. Yes. Let's start with Kosovo.
Good morning, Chair, and members and colleagues. Thanks for giving us some space to come back to you. I think Chair just made us say a few things, and we'll try to the point. We didn't get a sense in the budget speech from the Chair that how is government going to prevent the recurrence of the wasteful expenditure for the past 2 years. So government asking for more money to plug the holes. The AG is talking about 64 billion loss to wasteful. How are we going to prevent that? We know it's not an easy magic wand, but simply replacing a chair of an airline board is not sufficient. The problems are much deeper than that. We also didn't get a sense of plan, Chair, from government and how they're going to recover the stolen money. And what we've seen from the law enforcement agencies is very disappointing. It looks more like public theatrics as opposed to actual concrete action. And again, how to prevent the repetition. In terms of SARS, again, we don't see a plan from government to fix up the crisis in SARS. And hence, we've seen the last 2 years, the revenue shortfall, not just because of the economic crisis, but also the state capture issues in SARS. We know Momo must be diplomatic, but at times, Chair, we need to be a bit more bold with government. We don't get a sense from government how they're going to crack down on tax evasion, because you can see huge discrepancies around the number of millionaires and those who pay. Chair, from us as unions, we really feel that workers are constantly blamed for the budget crisis, as if it's a sin for nurses want to earn a living wage, and as if those workers don't support extended families. We don't get a sense of cuts on the top in the wage bill, in government or the parastatals. But look, we are willing to engage with government, whether it's a public sector bargaining council, it's here the leadership of parliament or NEDLAC. We have moderated the amount of strikes, even the wage negotiations, even this year the public service bargaining council negotiations. Many issues, we find ways to be creative and to moderate it. insensitive to the government crisis. We've seen a 3% headcount reduction, so as if we're just blaming public servants for being the cause of this issue. Chair, the President really spoke boldly and correctly around stabilizing the SOEs, and you've seen how workers have helped stabilize ESCOM by borrowing the five billion rand from the PIC, but we don't get a sense of a macro plan to save the SOEs. Chair, look, our COSATU CEC finished yesterday, and I think you might have seen it on the news. There's a deep sense of anger amongst workers and unions. We really feel, to be simple, that the elite have stolen money, and our workers will pay back the money. And one the reaction we're getting already from our affiliates is that, well, in the industrial side, they're going to add 1% VAT for the wage demand. Public sector unions are likely to do the same. They will no longer want inflation plus whatever, want inflation plus that plus whatever. And I'm sure I also expect there's already a bit of mobilization around possible strikes as well, if you continue this route. Chair, our figure on the budget is that the tax changes are simply targeting the working and middle classes. There's no new measures to assist the poor. And our call in summary, Chair, to your good selves and to government is that within the 16-day time frame, two options. One is either to cancel VAT and to increase the variety of other taxes that we propose, from company, the wealthy, luxury goods, estate duties, import duties, etc., or to significantly expand the VAT exempt groups, so to other essential foods, but I think also to issues of medicines, sanitary pads, or the essential toiletries, school uniforms, and textbooks. We think if you're going to go this VAT route, you have to at least do that. And it must be done now in the 16-day period before the 1st of April. Simply to say that we're going to consult experts, we'll look at 2019. I think that'll be too late, Chair. To quote one member, esteemed member of the Politburo of the Bangalore Party, I think if we delay that, we're likely to see, as he likes to say, blood on the floor. Definitely the end of the political honeymoon, unfortunately. And we think, Chair, we'll see a rise in strikes and a potential black backlash between April and May 2019, when the next elections take place, Chair. We want to really avoid that. So, Chair, we're hoping our proposals will assist in going forward, but we think we must at least expand the VAT exempt group significantly. We don't like that route, really, because our fear that what often happens is the retailers just pocket the money themselves, because government doesn't control prices. But I think there must be some gesture from government, Chair. Thanks very much.
The Minister of Finance got that assignment from the Cabinet. So yes, and we are here to do the monitoring and the oversight over that process, to report to us and engage again with you. Okay? Fine. But he said that Professor was his boss.
Yes, in my one hand, but I'm representing 30 civil society organizations from out of mission.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, and to the Treasury. A few points. First is, we appreciate the feedback under a very short time constraint. I would urge the National Treasury, when they're summarizing our inputs, to attempt to try and capture some of the nuance which we offered. So for example, we explained quite assertively that we feel that the point of regressivity and progressivity is that the argument we're making is not whether VAT is this or isn't this. It's that the increase to VAT is increasing the regressivity of the overall tax mix. Right, and that's a point which goes beyond just arguing if it's regressive or progressive. Similarly, we're not necessarily saying taxes are all low. We're saying that there's room to increase them. So that level of nuance, I think, is just important. On the question of the budget review, which we must compliment Treasury for this very thorough annual document, as well as providing us with the Excel sheet, etc. But the point raised about information and scenarios and alternatives goes far beyond what's found inside. It's written in a very accessible way, which is very good, but it deals with many of these issues in a paragraph. You know, there isn't a serious interrogation there of what the various options were or are. There isn't a serious interrogation of many of the issues raised around zero rating and so on. So let's see it for what it is, which is the useful public handbook. We want to note with concern, although we won't speak to this much here, issues of social services. On page 53 of the budget review, it notes that large provincial conditional grants for school infrastructure, education infrastructure, human settlements, provincial roads, municipal infrastructure, electrification, urban settlements, and public transport have all been cut. And we'll return to these issues in the appropriate follow-up hearing. The next thing is that I think it's important, members, that when we speak about the tax obligations, that we take a slightly longer-term view than the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. So the National Treasury has rightly shown, you know, that the personal income tax, for instance, has been increased recently. But, you know, that must be viewed in the context of what we showed on Wednesday, which is a dramatic fall over the last 20 years. So that a person earning a 2 million rand now is paying 50,000 rand more than they were 3 or 4 years ago is in the context of the fact that they're paying 150,000 rand less than they were in 1999. And so I urge us to bear that long-term context in mind. Our contention is not that nothing's been done. That would be a ridiculous one. There's been, you know, there's been increases through bracket creeps, through the new tax bracket on the personal income tax side, on capital gain side. We heard about that. Our contention is that this is insufficient on those taxes. On capital gains, there's been a raising of the exclusion threshold through which certain amounts are excluded. Why any should be excluded is the question. So we've gone from 30% or 40% to 80%. You know, so it's not about saying that we think that there's been no measures. It's about opening up a conversation about whether there's more room and whether there has enough on those fronts. In the slides which present the options around different personal income tax options, which obviously we're all seeing for the first time, there isn't an indication in those slides about why a choice was made not to go for these scenarios. The sort of only element which, and I might be misunderstanding, is the argument that this is the least detrimental for GDP growth. I mean, if we just pause and think in a sort of just in a common sense kind of way, okay? If we're asserting that all tax increases hurt GDP growth, I mean, there's three ways which we substantiate that: either based on economic theory, right, or based on evidence from the past, or based on economic modeling. Okay. Now, I mean, who builds roads? Who invests in digital infrastructure? Who oversees South Africa's public services, healthcare? You know, I mean, this this what I'm trying to avoid delving into economic theory. But these, just for some time. I mean, if we look, these claims are based on a sort of a very narrow neoclassical understanding of economic theory, right? Just in the same way as in the 1990s, everybody argued that government spending crowds out private sector growth. Okay, right? That was a theoretical paradigm we heard over and over again. 10 years later, everyone now acknowledges that government spending can crowd in private sector growth. There are, I would argue, much more recent and nuanced ways of understanding the relationship between economic growth and tax. So, for instance, in one study cited in the appendix, it argues that personal income tax growth distorts, I mean, personal income tax distorts growth through reducing savings. As early as 2001, the IMF argued that this is not so, and they gave a, and I have a quote here which I can share, but they explained why, based on economic theory, this is not necessarily the outcome. Similarly, there's been a wealth of evidence that higher personal income tax and corporate tax rates can reduce inequality. To quote from the OECD chief economist, tax hikes that can bolster equality and have relatively little impact on long-term growth, such as real estate, should be considered. Meanwhile, hikes in capital income taxes would be positive for equity and would not necessarily distort growth, while shifting tax burdens from labor and towards green consumption taxes, for instance, would also bring benefits. So, I mean, this is a seminar which we need to have. But I reject as both counter in intuitive and as unsound the idea that all the tax increases have a detrimental growth impact. Nor does the evidence uniformly support that. The last thing on that chair is that the statistical modelling, which is then used to then try and bolster these claims, and we noted this in brief on Wednesday, are essentially designed in a manner where your model has a series of equations. How you build those equations, how you make one thing interact with like another thing, will impact on the outcome. And in the model used, the equations are built in such a way that any increase in these taxes will always have a negative growth impact. And I've looked through those equations, and if there's questions, I can explain why on each of them. That is the only available outcome in the CGE model which is used. My last substantive point here is on public financing and on debt. And I think we've, you know, the ratings agencies have been very useful to us in civil society, because we've managed to go and clobber a president which we didn't like by with rating agency downgrade. But we do need to take a slightly sort of broader view of this boogeyman. Rating agencies themselves actually do. They cite borrowing costs as only one as a number of issues which concern them. In South Africa, our borrowing costs are in the lowest sort of quarter, or about a quarter from the bottom of OECD countries, our debt levels. I think it's the debt metric is not the only concern of rating agencies. In the main, rating agencies care about growth and stability. Our SOEs have been a real concern, as has governance issues. And so the metric used is also important, because that metric is a ratio. It's a debt to GDP ratio. Even if we borrow at the exact same amount, if we increase growth, that ratio falls. So I think debt borrowing is something which needs to be viewed in the terms of what is it being used for. And if we increase borrowing in a way which stimulates growth, it can overall lead to a fall in that debt ratio. So I think we just also need to have a more nuanced conversation than to sort of wave this as this boogeyman in a simplistic way. My last point is about process, which was raised at the very outset, which is that we understand that tax issues is a market sensitive matter and so on. What we said on Wednesday was not necessarily that the process needs to be one of here's our decision, let's have a conversation about it. There can be a 3 to 6 month conversation with public engagement about what the slew of options are. That's an open and transparent engagement, after which government goes off and presents their decision. So I don't think that public engagement on these issues is necessarily in conflict with the sensitivity of these issues. I'm sorry that's a bit all over, but it's been difficult in this short period of time to condense those thoughts. I'm going to hand over quickly.
Just on the final 2 points from civil society, the one issue that Treasury has raised is the question of a luxury VAT rate. They dispense with that in a couple of paragraphs on page 44 of the budget review. There's no evidence, no studies that are put on the table, and I think it relates to the point that that Gillard was making, which is that there has to be a proper debate which puts forward, it can't be an ideological assertion that this is not feasible. In the 1990s already, we were calling for the VAT system to be made more progressive, including through the introduction of luxury VAT rate. And what we showed was that there are numerous countries, both developing and developed, which had introduced a luxury VAT rate. Now, since then, despite commitments to look at various possibilities, etc., we've seen the tax mix, which Gillard referred to, we've seen the tax mix go in the opposite direction of a more progressive system. And in fact, we now have this proposed VAT increase, which makes the tax mix more aggressive. So we need the committee needs to consider what are the arguments for a luxury rate, what is the international experience. And I think that this notion, and again it comes across as very ideological, this idea that you can have a complex PIT, personal income tax system, which is easily administered by SARS with many, many different levels, but you can't do the same for a VAT system because suddenly it becomes too complicated. I think it doesn't hold water. Secondly, this notion of the ad valorem tax and the luxury excise duties is raised as an alternative to luxury rate. But what Treasury is not telling us is how the increase in the excise duties and the ad valorem duties is going to fill the revenue hole. If you look at the budget review, basically what they're saying is that there's an increase of about R1 billion in these duties, as opposed to R23 billion, which is going to come from VAT. So there's no sense in which there's a fair distribution of the burden, if that burden is going to be shared at all. So if Treasury wants to engage in a discussion about the relative merits of a luxury VAT rate versus other luxury taxes, ad valorem, excise duties, etc., then that's fine. That would be a useful engagement to have. But then it must be transparent. Then it must be said, we are going to try to get an additional R15 billion, say, for example, through luxury rates, either through a specific 20%, for example, 25% rate, VAT rate, or through increasing these other ad valorem and excise duties. And what are the policy objectives of doing that? Obviously, the one is equity. But the other is that you're deterring luxury imports. You're deterring luxury imports, and you are dealing with one of the big problems for our balance of payments, which is that we are importing massive amounts of luxury goods, which is detrimental to our balance of payments. And secondly, what we're doing is we are acting against local production. So to the extent that you raise those luxury taxes, you are deterring those luxury imports, improving your balance of payments, and you're promoting domestic production. So it's not just about equity, but it is about equity, but it's also about these other considerations, which is why it's like the national minimum wage versus sectoral wage sort of debate, which is a national minimum wage, everybody can see it, set at R20 an hour. There are many sectoral wages, nobody knows what those are. A VAT rate would be a similar idea, that everybody knows that there's 20 or 25% luxury rate. But no one knows, if you ask anyone in this room now, what are these ad valorem, excise duties, etc., no one knows what they are, except we see in the budget review that there's a 5 to 7% increase, so from 5 to 7%, so it's still less than half of the VAT rate. So we can embark on a discussion about that if Treasury is serious about raising significant amounts of revenue through that, then I think they need to put that on the table in a transparent way. The final point is in relation to the process issue, is that civil society, the trade unions, etc., have been putting these issues on the table, as I say, for decades now, since the 1990s. And I think that anything which kicks something into a process, which is open-ended, which says they're going to be experts, there are going to be expert panels, there are going to be studies, etc., which has no sense of urgency about it, I think the sort of result, the sort of consequences which Matthew was talking about from Kasatu is certainly that sort of approach is going to be unacceptable, and it's simply going to provoke a greater reaction. So I think if Treasury is talking about a genuine process within very tight time frames, put a moratorium on the increase in VAT until those decisions have been taken, study all the evidence, allow all the experts to come, look at how the alternative forms of revenue can be achieved, then I think they're talking about something serious. If it's some open-ended process which is going to drag on for years, then I think there's no way that civil society is going to be prepared to accept that. Next.
Thank you, Chairperson, and honourable members. I didn't make a written submission, but unfortunately I couldn't come down on Wednesday, so my response will partly touch on that submission and also touch on some of the things said by Treasury. Just to clarify, I'm wearing one hat. So I do advise some civil society organizations, but I don't endorse positions. So I see my kind of role here as providing some critical oversight of claims by National Treasury and trying to make some constructive contributions around the Parliament oversight process. On the issue of process in relation to things said by the National Treasury, I do think it's disingenuous for Treasury to come to these committees and to make arguments about the appropriateness.
Nobody speaks very fast. You know that. It's not always with me.
Can you slow down a bit?
Sure. I do think it's disingenuous for National Treasury to come to the committees and make arguments about it being more appropriate to make changes over the medium term when there were significant departures from the medium-term budget policy statement in the 2018 budget review. How are civil society and the House Parliament supposed to make those inputs when all that was present in the medium-term budget policy statement was vague claims about possible expenditure cuts and revenue increases? Similarly, on the issue of VAT, there's been nothing stopping National Treasury from initiating the kind of process that the DDG was referring to in terms of consultation. It didn't require a commitment to a VAT increase. And so I think it's reasonably obvious that the approach that's been taken, whether intentionally or not, essentially leads to the possibility that this just becomes a fait accompli. It's just something that cannot be changed. And that does undermine the oversight process. So I think that is problematic. The committees are faced with two sets of decisions, as I'm sure you know. The first is around the fiscal framework, and the second is around the revenue proposals. The issue I raised around the MTBPS last year was the Treasury abandoned fiscal consolidation and didn't replace it with any credible alternative fiscal policy. And that was a concern that arguably contributed to the downgrade. What we now see is a return to fiscal consolidation, but at higher levels of debt than promised in previous budgets. So if members accept the fiscal framework, then that's essentially what you're accepting. I'm not going to say much about that, but just one thing to note is that I have written a fair bit about the free higher education issue. It's hard to see that the decisions made are consistent with constitutional obligations, given that the massive increase in free higher education funding coincides with cuts to more basic social expenditure areas that arguably receive greater priority in the Constitution, and the selection of taxes that, as people have already seen, are borne more by the poor and working class than other tax options. The second set of issues are the revenue proposals, and in my submission what I suggested, given concerns, for example, around VAT, is that the committees can separate these issues. You can accept the fiscal framework and still retain the possibility of rejecting, for example, the VAT increase. And I should add, it has only come up explicitly in the public hearing, but this shouldn't have any effect on the downgrade issue. So my view, which I don't think is very controversial, is that the ratings agencies, except in extreme situations, shouldn't really have an opinion on what tax instruments the government is using to raise revenue. So once you've accepted the fiscal framework, you're accepting a fiscal consolidation plan, and that is one of the main focuses of the ratings agencies. So what that means is it opens up the possibility to have a more extensive engagement around issues like VAT, with the one caveat that the intention is to implement this on the 1st of April. And so that now provides some additional time pressure. But there's potentially more time to discuss the revenue proposals than just the 16 days in which the committees have to report. The second thing I wanted to talk about was this issue of regressivity versus progressivity. And again, I mentioned this in my submission. I think it's very important to distinguish between technical definitions and the way we normally use these words in popular discussion and in political discussion. A tax instrument can be mildly progressive, but you could still think of it from a political point of view as being regressive because it will impose significant costs on the poor. So the technical definition is just about which income categories, what proportion does each income category pay? So if the top income categories pay a slightly higher proportion of their income, then you would call it mildly progressive. But it could still have a very significant negative impact on the poor. So now, whether in a political sense that's progressive or regressive depends to some extent on how concerned you are about the impact on the poor relative to other groups, right? So these are not the same thing. So a lot of the discussion has been focused on the technical definitions. And from my reading of all the submissions, I think all the submissions I've seen are correct, although they frame these issues differently. So it is true that the Woolard et al. Paper and the DTC found that VAT with zero rating is mildly progressive, VAT without zero rating is regressive. I think the same was true for the fuel levy, just because also in South Africa wealthy people tend to drive a lot. But that doesn't mean that those instruments don't have a negative impact on the poor. Okay? So I think it's important to distinguish those issues. When it comes to sort of progressivity, National Treasury has made a number of statements about the overall budget and the overall tax mix. I don't think anybody's questioning the fact that the overall budget is progressive based on the allocations. The paper by Woodard and others looked at that and showed that the overall, the combination of taxation and government spending did reduce inequality. So I don't think that's a matter of debate. What's being debated is that the proposals that are being presented in the budget, are those progressive in the political sense relative to alternatives that could have been considered? That's the nature of the debate. So I think looking, I think talking about historical allocations, and of course the Constitution requires those allocations anyway, is potentially a little bit misleading. I'll come to the question about information. National Treasury said they didn't go into distributive issues in the budget review because the evidence is mixed. Now, that's clearly problematic because there are statements or insinuations in the budget review about distributional issues. For example, National Treasury says, we've allocated an extra 2.6 billion rand to social grants in order to offset the effect of VAT. Well, you should have some estimate of what the effect of VAT was on those groups and the extent to which social grants will offset that. Where is that evidence? And that evidence wasn't provided in the budget review. I mean, Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think this graph around VAT across income deciles was in the budget review. So it's here now, so that's great. But that kind of information should be there, and it should be combined with information about social grant allocations. Treasury does have models. They may not be fully happy with them, and nobody's ever fully happy with a model, but they should present the evidence that they have to support the claims they're making. I should add, that's not unreasonable, because when Parliament makes changes, amendments to revenue proposals or the fiscal framework, Parliament has to satisfy a range of criteria in the Money Bills Act, and one of them is looking at equity. So the question is, why should Parliament have to satisfy those criteria? National Treasury is not doing it adequately, given their massive resources and capacity, when they present the budget review, which has been developed over many months. So next point, just about the taxation options. I just want to explain this one difference between estimates and modelling, and I've partly been covered here by Gilad. When we talk about who pays how much tax, that paper was just based on actual household surveys that we have. It's an estimate. So there's nothing controversial about that in most cases. I don't think anybody's contesting the findings of that paper. So we're reasonably comfortable that that paper gives us an indication of who's paying how much tax when the paper was done, about 2014. The issue about the effect of different tax proposals is based on modeling. Those models are based on particular assumptions, and those assumptions, as Gilad was saying, can be challenged. So for example, in most of those models, it's just assumed that income tax has a negative effect on the amount of effort that people put into work, productivity, and therefore necessarily has a negative effect on economic growth. For example, those models don't take into account the fact that VAT might decrease the income available to the poor, which might constrain job search, which could constrain economic growth. That's not an assumption in the model. So these things should be contested, and as Gilad has pointed out, in other contexts, these kinds of assumptions have been abandoned. But we can't have that discussion in the very limited time we have for these public hearings. So without going into too much more detail, first bottom line is National Treasury should have had this debate earlier. They didn't have to wait for a back announcement in order to have a discussion about the merits of VAT. The second point is we need to distinguish between estimates about who's paying the tax versus modeling about these changes, and that also applies to these assumptions about economic growth. So, Chair, if I can just finish with points about information, and it's hard because I understand Treasury has to aggregate all the submissions, so I don't know if they're referring to mine or to others. Treasury argued that they provide information on distributional effects, but their reference was to the personal income tax table. I don't know about others, but that wasn't the point I was making. The point I was making is, what is the net distributional effect of the revenue proposal in the budget review? And that's never been provided, and I have been raising this issue, I think, now for 2 or 3 years. The second is that the claims about CIT and PIT, I would say, are fully substantiated, both in the budget review, but also in the approach of just citing what I would say, you know, arbitrary academic papers. But academic papers certainly weren't cited in the budget review. And of course, I mean, as an academic, I can tell you that one can be quite selective with how one cites the academic literature. But the final point to make is this. If one accepts those arguments from National Treasury, then arguably what we're hearing is that in future, the intention is in fact to decrease the contributions from PIT and CIT. Because what we're hearing is that the trend is downward on CIT, we've reached the threshold, so does that mean that this is now a large change in tax policy from national treasury, that in the future we're going to be switching to indirect taxes, because we're giving up on trying to claim enough tax from wealthy individuals and from corporations? And if that is the case, then again, national treasury needs to come and substantiate, why is it that personal income tax revenue is underperforming? Has national treasury done everything that they should to close those loopholes? Similarly, in relation to CIT, these committees have spent a lot of time talking about base erosion and profit shifting. Is the inability to raise more money from CIT just something that you have to accept, or is it something that Treasury can do something about? So there are very substantive issues that need to be discussed here, and I think it is problematic that once again the committees are being forced to deal with them in a very short period of time, and civil society is required to do the same. Thank you.
Good ladies, your opportunity.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Vivian Mintulalu, and I'm with the Dala Umar Institute representing Parliament Watch. My colleague Sam Waterhouse, who presented to you on Wednesday, apologizes that she cannot be here. In the interest of time, because a lot of our points have been covered, there's just one key point I'd like to emphasize, and this is of particular importance to Parliament Watch, because Parliament Watch's main aim is to facilitate and capacitate civil society and community-based organizations and activists to access the legislature and participate in governance matters meaningfully. And as much as we are noting Treasury's efforts around the portal that they've mentioned, as well as the budget lockup, as well as the Davis Tax Committee, we do feel that there's more that Treasury can do to facilitate public participation. And some of my colleagues have alluded to that in terms of what kind of information they make available, when they make that information available, and other methods to engage more meaningful participation in the budget-making process annually. And that's all in the interest of time. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. An open invitation. For the next 9 months, we will be engaging in revenue bonds, tax. Come and attend it and make your inputs. That's an open invitation. Just watch the advertisements in the media. And that's from Parliament side. We invite you to come and engage. Treasury got the message. The other point. If we reject the VAT proposal, we'll have to find 22.9 billion rand in the next 20 days. That's the reality. So the options isn't so many. We are dealing with the real situation. And the Minister of Finance received an assignment from Cabinet, from the President. You've got homework, sir. Go and do it. Engage with society, you people, and come and report that and report to Parliament. Treasury. You want to reply? Members here, quickly.
You know, when the discussion unfolded, I remember the remarks of Nkwakwa when he said he doesn't want an ideological debate. Now he missed an opportunity to listen to a very interesting ideological debate. I'm not going to comment on that because of the limitations of time, but I've got about 7 or 8 questions.
Yeah, I've got
32
actually.
But we'll
have the same time everybody else.
Yeah, we always have 32 or 50 or 100. Yeah. Now, basically, it's clarification so that we expunge some of the notions that have been presented by National Treasury. And so that going forward, we understand. There has been, the first one is, at some point, we'll have to engage intensively on the issue, because it's an issue that has been posed on us, whether do you believe that indirect taxes should be a model that we need to utilize for economic growth. That's an argument for another day. I think we need to get into it. There's an issue about the type of models that you've used. Other saying tax tools are not necessarily panacea to address economic growth and so on. So I've noted quite a few of the issues that are very interesting that we need to come
and engage at some point, and I think we'll make suggestions. But let me, including whether do you believe through excise taxes will be able to generate enough revenue? Those are fundamental questions that we can't ignore and pretend that they have not been posed to us. One of the fundamental issues is that they suggest that you are using a tax too late way to address revenue challenges when they see other. So I'll leave those issues. But let me go to this one. There is this question that we need to have a different target model for zero rating. And we can't postpone it forever for a very long time. It needs immediate interventions that we need to speak to in the current conjunction. I suggest that I don't know how National Treasury is going to respond to it now, based on what Momoe suggested later about the need to involve experts. But I raised a concern that was raised in the public that we need to also look at how it's going to affect service delivery. And I made the suggestion about social services like water and electricity. That can be attended in the meeting, where a policy can be put in place to address those who are indigent, not to be affected by VAT in electricity. I'm just reminding you of that. The second issue is in terms of the allocation. Provinces get more and local government gets 9%, and local government is going to be affected more. Is it possible that you can look at how we can reduce it? Because services, basic services are at the level of local government. Provincial government are administration share, and they tend to get a higher share. It's in the document. And there's an argument that in terms of what we've provided for social services, it is below inflation. Now, I want us to quantify it. That research is actually, I think Ian Zhu who responded to that, higher than inflation, but it did not give the percentage. Maybe if you can give that, it will be able to address that question. In terms of business incentives, there's an argument that comes from civil society that those business incentives have benefited foreign investors as opposed to local investors. Maybe we want to lift up, I know the motor industry, for instance, has always benefited. I'm talking from my previous life in the industry. I have always prioritized locally produced motor vehicle components, and we have incentivized them a lot. BMW and VW and so on has been the direct beneficiary thereof. Perhaps we need to speak more to it so that the reflection shows that it's actually more about localization as opposed to foreign direct investment. Because that's the argument that civil society is raising in this country. I'm trying to move very fast. There's also an argument going to arise during the debate. You see, when GEAR was introduced, people argued that it was a jobless group. Now, there's going to be an argument that's going to be advanced again, whether is this going to create jobs? The relief that there's going to be an argument that, you know, you've looked only at social grants and education, but how is this going to affect jobs? So we'll have to answer that question. I'm rounding up. Okay. I'm also a little bit vindicated on the issues of rating agencies, but an element came that I never thought of before. An element that suggests that rating agencies does not only look at tax instruments, but they look at your GDP to growth and your debt stabilization and economic growth. Maybe we should answer that question so that you can assist us as when we deal with that argument. How do we call it in such a way that it can address that way? Not only attended to this issue based on one sided approach of tech tools that we could utilize in the economy, but we have also looked at all other aspects to balance the fiscal framework in terms of structural changes. I think, yeah, let me leave it at
you. Anyone else? Or Valise?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you to everyone who's presented this morning. I've really enjoyed it in a good sense. It's been very useful. Is that better? Can you still hear me? So thank you very much indeed. I'm just going to take them in the same order as we had them. I think you've made some very important points. Exactly how we deal with them is probably going to take some time to deal with. However, I do think that the issue of the process from the MTBPS to this budget was significantly different from history. The last MTBPS left us hanging in the air, painted the bad picture, but gave no indication of any substance as to how we were going to deal with the bad picture. So in a sense, that's, I think, part of the problem now, where everyone is kind of trying to get on top of what's being proposed, whereas the intention, I think, has always been that the MTBP gets us ready for the new budget, and it didn't happen this time. In terms of the zero-rated additions, you're suggesting a process to identify whether any should or should not and what they should be. So at this stage, then, there's no indication from Cabinet or anyone else about what should be added to that list or taken off the list. That's certainly what I'm hearing from you, but if you could just confirm that. And Chris, the additional $10 billion rand in contingency reserve is vital, but it seems that in the budget there's no real provision for the high-risk things like Eskom. Eskom, we know, managed to finally get its $20 billion yesterday or the day before. It's paying back the $5 billion to the PIC and the GEPF. But it's going to run out of cash again at the end of March, as I understand it. And it seems to be the ratings agency's understanding too, given that they've downgraded on the basis that they think that Eskom's probably going to default later this year. And what I'm saying is there any plan to deal just with Eskom? Because they're going to either default or going to need a bailout of some sort. The question of the 6 billion rand draft relief, I haven't been able to unpack that as to exactly who can get access to that money yet. And I know I asked that question in a previous discussion, but I think it's quite critical because the draft is not just a City of Cape Town issue. The Eastern Cape, fortunately in my part of KwaZulu-Natal, suddenly in the last 2 weeks the dams are overflowing. But 2 weeks ago, Skeenkop Dam was still, I think, about 50% full, and it should have been overflowing in December. But it's okay now, but there are other parts of the country which are facing quite severe consequences. Another risk that I suppose should be part of the Eskom discussion is the RAF fund, the RAF. When I say RAF, I kind of think of stiff fires and things, but it shows my age, I suppose. I'm reading your table. So as of the end of the current financial year, the entity is 215 billion rand in the red. Not million, 215 billion rand in the red. I mean, that's a massive, massive. Now, how does one get to that? I mean, what are these liabilities of 225 billion? What is the age of them? Are they going to K come to court in the next 6 months and have to be met if the courts rule that way. How do we, can we get some detail of those 225 billion? Because the risk there seems to be enormous. We're talking about Eskom's guarantees of nearly 300 billion, but here we have a direct liability of 225. Chris, I think you've been somewhat naughty with your graph on page. I can't find it now. There is the one about the tax to GDP ratio. Tax to GDP ratio don't indicate where the tax burden falls, and so the comparison shouldn't be tax to GDP ratio. The comparison should be Chris Axel versus the other Chris in the United States. That kind of apples with apples kind of comparison. Or let's say then personal income tax here versus somewhere else. So, you know, if you were, you know, drill down into that, we know that there are very few taxpayers involved in paying that tax in South Africa, and how does that compare? So I know it's not inaccurate, but damn stats. You can make the point that I think others have been making if you suit your argument. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Leash. Anyone else? Member Chitoy?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the input by Treasury. I really appreciate that you have done your best under a very difficult environment. But you see, as a rural woman, I really feel that we should have more discussion on this addition to tax, because there are families that have no income at all where I come from. There are families who have no income. An increase in transport will mean increase in taxi fares. So, you know, when I think of it, it means these families will literally be grounded. I think we should talk more about it. But as you have said yourself that you think this is not usually helpful towards redress. We should find a way of looking at other avenues. You also said that one of you said the thing is there are very few people with high income. And of course, in a situation, South African situation, where you have evergreen contracts in all this infrastructure, you expect that there will only be a few people. And we should look at that area so that we open up for other people to enter into the market so that we have got more people paying tax than we have now. Lastly, on transparency. You know, the Constitution puts the responsibility of looking after state assets on Treasury. And when you think of Treasury, you think of an institution that will be very conscious of the Public Finance Management Act, the supply chain laws, Treasury regulation. But it was in the public domain that it was in Treasury that all these laws were ignored. And we in the integrated financial management system, and we're not getting a sense that Treasury is very serious on actually disciplining or making those people pay back the money. I don't hear it. And unless Treasury takes that stance, nobody else will be very willing to do what you are saying, because you are not living up to that yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Stolle. You're a rural woman, I'm a rural man. So, yes, my whole province is rural. Don't you?
Because of the times other people have drifted away, instead of asking so many questions, maybe I should give some opportunity when we come to the last section where people give proposals to suggest some based partly on our study group, but I've got some other things I want to raise. Some ideas on how we might try to structure our report and what we should put in it in a way that compromises between what the polarized parties have said. Maybe I use my time for that, so I'll leave it for now. Yes.
Omo, you and your team.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think, look, it's not really... I think there's been lots of questions asked, and I think to deal with all the issues, sometimes some issues are best dealt with through, like, workshops and so on. And I think we've committed to continue to engage on those. I think it's not helpful when people, when we debate, sort of accuse, use words like misleading, accused, didn't give this information. You know, it's not helpful.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
You will remember, all the members, when we started the briefing last week, I told you we must go back to our own resolutions on the MTBB issue. And we took a resolution on a quarterly basis to engage with the Treasury on those issues. I'm just sensitizing that we feature this into our two commodities programs. Yes, but...
On our side, I know the burden on your committee, because you have two committees and one with one chair. We should recommend our report timely that Comrade Shah gets paid two salaries anyway, because they're two separate chairs. But to come back to the issue, we do have a quarterly review with Treasury every quarter. This quarter, because of the Capitec and Steinhoff and DAP increase, we took a decision on Tuesday, or Wednesday, to drop this quarterly one and to have two. So we do that. And in fact, the issues we look at, amongst the issues we look at, we say, what have you said in response to our MTDPS report? So it is part of our report. We don't say thank you.
Please proceed.
So I think to the extent that we can, we will sort of engage where particularly people, I think, approach this constructively and think it helps. I think that when we hear the issues, there are obviously sometimes the issue is one of information, sometimes it's ideological. And obviously you have your own preferences and so on. And in a way, it's important, I think, just to look at the issues. I think we've tried to say we are in a big hole, and I think the budget, whilst it's an important, a very important document in government and it brings things together, it doesn't deal with all the problems in government. So it can't, let's say we can refer to the issue of RAF. We would hope that there are processes that get taken up and that there's a specific hearing on the RAF. Of course, as you know, the way Parliament's structured, that would be often in a transport committee, maybe not in a finance committee. So the financial consequences, I think, of and the sustainability of those funds often don't get prioritized within the entire system for whatever reason. I think just in terms of process too, you know, Cabinet tends to make the decisions on the actual tax options sort of later in the day, okay? While there's a lot of discussion, obviously, after MTBPS, the reality is this was not an option government was happy to proceed with. And so there was no real decision taken. I'm not saying we couldn't have better handled MTBPS. I think in retrospect, the fact that we didn't offer solutions and the debt seems to be going up, obviously there was a strong reaction to it. You know, as a public servant, I need to be careful how I say it. But when the politics is difficult and doesn't actually get to make decisions or get to make decisions late, it's very hard to then come to Parliament and say these are the proposals the government has, and so on. I think, too, it would be useful, despite what's been said, what are the alternatives? We can say excise on luxury goods, but we do need, even if they're back on the envelope numbers, do they make sense? I mean, yesterday, Donald Trump talked about 25% on steel tariffs, okay, and the impact on trade. The market sort of was shaken by his statement. I mean, how much can you protect an economy? Those are, you know, different discussions. Let's have them. But I think that the budget takes this at the end point. When we say people are more mobile, well, people go overseas and they buy those luxury goods if you make the tax too high here on iPads or whatever. These are the imported products we use. I plead guilty. But let's see amongst us who's not guilty. And let's see whether just by having a very high tax, people don't buy that then it, because people go overseas. So I'm just saying in all of these, one needs to balance. And certainly I find it staggering to say the Edmund issues of a VAT are no different from the Edmund issues in complexity to PIT. PIT, we make every employer an agent of SARP. So they actually have to deduct, even before you can spend it, as you know, your amounts are deducted. VAT, every person selling something, most of them are bad dealers, sometimes at the end of the chain not. So it's enormously complex, and SARS will have to scale up tremendously to try and get anti-tax avoidance measures. And yes, let me plead guilty too, that I don't know the logistics of how SARS collects, what are the admin challenges, but that's something you need to ask SARS. We sit in our ivory tower and do the policy. We understand that there are difficulties with administration, but I don't think that when you get to different rates, then the scope of people declaring goods to be this category and not that category is enormous. And one can't police every transaction. So, and that's why you have all these commissions on taxation coming to a particular view. So it's not impossible. Nothing's impossible. It can be done, but there's high cost, there's high admin, and so on. I think I won't go into the nitty-gritty of the process. I think any process can be improved. But it's also, I think, important that at some point hard decisions have to be made. And I think in this, government has had to, with great difficulty, make these decisions. And even delaying it, because zero rating is not sorted out. You know, if you're collecting, it says 22 billion, but let's say it's 24 billion for VAT. And let's say it's linear, okay, the seasonal factory. But that means every month you delay, it's 2 billion less. And we don't say that the expenditure is going to be 2 billion less until the zero rating is sorted out. So what happens is your deficit is actually going to be bigger. And we are a government who are reliant on the markets to go and borrow, as we saw with state-owned entities, that when the markets close, then it forces the budget to come up with funds. And that's very difficult. I think, Mr. Lee, your question on to have a plan for ESCOM. Frankly, ESCOM is so big, we can't put as a contingency 200 billion, okay, or 20 billion. It's just too big. We have to make sure we fix up ESCOM. And yes, I agree with Matthew that, you know, just changing the board and so on is not enough. Because I think Edward said in the President's speech, there are structural problems. Some of the SOEs are borrowing for their operational costs. Either their cost structure is too high, there's a lot of corruption theory that there must be savings from that. But until somebody goes and you put good management to solve those problems, you can't do this from the sidelines. I mean, so, and I think very important in government, make people responsible for specific things, and then you know whose ass to kick.
when something doesn't happen. Okay. Oh, what did I say? Yes, I think that's what I said. Okay. So I think that there's issues like that do come up. I think on issues like information on exercise, those are easily available once the lists are. In fact, in the budget review itself, there's long body tables, which I confess are hard to read, but they're there. Okay. Similarly, if you want to go either into the SARS website and so on, you should be able to get maybe along there. I haven't gone in myself, but those things are known. They get gazetted. There'll be in some gazette and so on. Anyway, those are the broader points. I think, and nobody's saying for the rating agencies they only look at one metric. They look at several, and each one is different. Obviously, when they publish their statements, they go into some take into account the politics more than others. But certainly, that they've been taking into account our politics, that's been an issue. I'll let my colleagues answer. And I think a lot of the other issues as to deal with corruption, I think we are equally frustrated. Yes, we're part of government, but why don't they get up and do things? The hawks say the NPAA delayed them by acting, but the hawks only acted in November. You had a hearing, chair, on that, okay? I don't know why they take so long, all of them took so long to act. And clearly, you know, the oversight in parliament should help the kind of, you know, we've had changes of president. All of those things are related to the fact that nothing was done. And let me say, and I know I'm being biased when I say, people are throwing lots of allegations. I will say on IFMS, there's no proof that even one cent has been stolen. But we're very happy, let's have forensic investigation. Let's have lifestyle audit. Should be done for all senior public servants. But some of these things have been used to discredit the Treasury, starting with ANN7. Okay? And frankly, some of those processes undermine the internal audit control systems. If you're going to look at internal audit units reports, they're going to be dirty and gory. And if they start being used, you lose them as a management tool. The issue is, what does management do when these issues come out? And I think it's been particularly unfair. Many members of parliament go and make all kinds of allegations. Well, that's a game both sides can play. Let all sides have lifestyle audits, as the president said. Because, I mean, and so I think in these issues, you know, let's not jump to conclusions. Let's have proper processes and let's see what the fault was. There might be bad judgment, but that's not a crime. Then let's punish or deal with the bad judgment made. But there were proper processes. If the opportunity is there, it will come out. I don't know on the specific issues on tax. Do you want to answer?
Thanks, Mama. Just a couple. I mean, on the points on the modelling, I agree. You can have models that are set up to give you specific results regardless of what you do, and you need to be careful of it. We try to have some cross-country comparisons, we try to have some of the empirical work that we look at, and we'd be happy to engage to look at it. So, and again, on the point of you can have selective academic articles that we put in presentations and things, I mean, I think that's why you're here to make sure that we don't do those selective type of articles. So we're very happy to engage on those. I mean, on the point on the luxury VAT, and there's no evidence and not being transparent, I mean, we thought we were being very transparent. I mean, the Margo Commission, which is set up to look at it, says to charge different rates of indirect tax on different goods and services is the most wasteful and ineffective way of trying to redistribute income. The CAPS Commission, which was also set up, the disadvantages of multiple VAT rates outweigh the possible redistributive gains available from this option. The Davis Tax Committee came also to say that luxury VAT was very difficult and we should rather use ad valorem excise duties. So we think there's a lot of evidence there. And I mean, if you just think about the admin side, if we were to make sushi a luxury VAT and charge 40%, now the retailer now has to charge a 40% VAT rate on sushi. Can they get an input VAT
refund of 40% on the rice used for the sushi. But now they'll say that they're selling a lot of sushi to get these huge import VATs, but maybe they're not. And the fish that's used as well. So now how do you differentiate? It's complicated. It creates arbitrage opportunities and it creates very difficulties on how far it actually applies. So it's not easy. The points on the distributional part of tax revenue, can I say noted on the tax revenue for the total distributional impact. And then the trend to indirect taxes, I mean hopefully if our forecasts come true and the revenues are calculated, you won't need big tax increases to reduce debt next year. But anyway.
Are you done?
I'll be very brief. I think most of we covered two points. The risks to this budget are huge. I want to state it again.
The risks to this budget are huge, and I want to state that again. Eskom is just one of the major risks we face, and we are well aware that a contingency reserve of 8 to 10 billion rand a year is never going to cover a major default, for example, and that's why so much work is being put into trying to stabilize these entities. But it's an important point to note that we are focusing the debate very much on one part of the tax system. But it's important to understand that, in fact, beyond the fiscal framework even, is the broader public sector, and there are major pressures appearing in different parts of the public sector, including the state-owned companies, and they are it. And of course, our goal is to avoid that that these eventually make their way onto the fiscal framework, but it is a risk, and it's something that we've highlighted. So this idea that we can only focus on very specific narrow elements of the fiscal framework, I would suggest we need to focus as well on these very large risks. And to try and give some more information on the Road Accident Fund. The Road Accident Fund is a complex animal, but what is going on there really is that there are actuarial estimates of how much is going to have to be paid out. That is that large number that Honourable Lees has just noted. That's an actuarial estimate of the total outstanding liability. It's not a guaranteed amount necessarily, because it's about whether those claims are finalized and have gone through the court process and so on. But to sum up, the Road Accident Fund is sitting on a big backlog of claims, and every time we raise the RAF levy to try and reduce those claims, that money, it's money that comes in and it goes out immediately. So that increase in the RAF fuel levy goes out immediately in the form of additional payments to road accident victims. And I know that the increase in the fuel levy was an issue that was noted, but it really is money that immediately goes out again into the system to pay road accident victims. And our argument is, and this is understood by government, if we want a sustainable system on the Road Accident Fund, we need to pass the Road Accident Benefit Scheme Bill, which is currently currently in Parliament. That bill needs to be passed as quickly as possible if we're going to start to reduce the rate at which this liability increases. And there has been a lot of work done about how do you pay down this debt, again, the outstanding RAF debt over the long term. The reality is that's also a very big and difficult decision that's going to have to be taken around how much do we increase the RAF levy or the RABS levy for the new bill in future in order to partially pay down this very large liability. So I think I'll leave it there.
Okay. I just wanted to make an additional question to what Chris has said. Regarding that, I mean, that in essence is a revenue raising instrument, and the broader the base is, the more efficient it is. Now, to try to think of that in terms of trying to address other issues compromises the tax instrument itself in terms of its purpose. So I think the debate around sort of like having multiple rates and all of that, I think they need to take into account the purpose of the tax instrument itself. And I think the reason our BEPS system is regarded as one of the best systems is that it has less exceptions or even sort of like zero ratings, because it was not intended to deal with the issues around redress and all of that. There should be other mechanisms that deal with providing relief. So the BEPS system is not the right tool to do that. And I think I should just make that point, because then to try to deal with those issues through multiple rates and also including a lot of exceptions basically then erode the base, and if you mean then to raise the same level of revenue, then the rate must be included in higher, because you have this distortion in the system, which also sort of like administrative wise compromises the tax instrument. PIT is great in terms of dealing with the issue around redistribution, because we are looking at income, and then, you know, it would be better to then look at how much the best can raise, and some of the expenditures then can be used in terms of other instruments to address those issues around providing a relief to low income households. I just needed to make that point.
Yes.
Fine, Chair. I think, so even in our presentation, we certainly not saying there shouldn't be wealth taxes. I mean, there are currently other, the estate duty, the donations tax. Capital gains has been raised, and I think Chris did explain it, in fact, twice the last few years. When it comes to the wealth tax, it is been looked at by Judge Davis and the Davis Tax Committee. They could not complete their work because, as I said on Wednesday, there are real complexities around it. And again, you know, we think we should do it, but don't think that you're going to get enough by way of revenue. Also, we need to start collecting information on people's assets. That's not generally asked for in tax returns and so on. So it's going to take a while before these things happen. I want to end up just with the last point. I think the biggest issue, Chair, for me, is still how effective are we in our spending. We are quite inefficient, okay? Aside from the composition not being right, because it's not really growth enhancing, the issue is the money really going to where it's supposed to go? And if not, why not? And that's where I think we still need to be bolder. So I took the example of the school feeding scheme. There's all kinds of things that happen. There's tenders, there's this, there's that. How much of that money actually goes to the ground, and how much of it happens, you know, imagine a hungry kid waiting for food at school, okay. If they don't know whether it's going to come, whether it comes at 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and the purpose is to give the child food before school starts, so that one day, you know, the brain begins to function. Now, I'm saying, shouldn't we be looking at some of those programs more intensely? I know they're out in the provinces, so you know, the oversight then is in provincial legislatures, but you would see in that all the conflicting objectives. When we came into government after 94, people who started, there was a strong view about, does it matter who delivers the textbooks or who delivers the food, because the biggest BE is getting school education right, okay. If the textbooks came late or didn't come at all, it impacts on learning. It's a huge cost. So I just think on these things, it would be good to look at those issues, because the key question for government is how best do we as government deal with poverty, to alleviate poverty. Then we can deal with what tax system can do, what the expenditure system can do. But I think you've got big failures on the expenditure side. Thank you, Chair.
Very important point. It's our job to visit our schools at least 3 times a year in our constituencies to address that point of the delivering of text material. I heard someone here on both funding.
Are we allowed to make comments?
Okay.
Okay, you see, look at how my chair looks at me.
No, he's the main chair. I'm just stuck.
Yeah, but you intimidate me before. Chair, my comment is it's very important that when we have engagement, it's not about debating only models that needs to be applied, but to get suggestions, especially from the public, that's going to assist us to answer very difficult questions. And I feel shortchanged in a way, I thought the process was going to yield a lot of input. Then I want to be specific, lest I be accused for making a generic statement. I thought when we related to issues of zero rating, I was going to hear a lot of suggestions that come from the public, those who are directly involved, you know, who are in organizations, and say in our community people use butter more than fat or something like that, and then why don't you do it? But it was very limited, honestly. I felt frustrated that when I said, can you come with an alternative suggestion? It was a serious limitation. People were saying, I don't know what I can suggest, but don't do this one. And you see, it's not very helpful for MPs if people just say that, because it's just feel good statements, but they're not answering the critical questions. And one of the fundamental questions was put on the table is that we need 2.2 billion grants, and how do you, what type of suggestions do you give us to address that question? Until now, it's not answered. So I believe that we'll go on our own to answer this question. Therefore, when we take decisions, it will be on the basis that we'll be addressing this in the meeting. And we're taking into account certain criticism that relate to scenarios that have been put in place. When I started reading economics, we were told that there's no model that is the perfect one or the correct one. So I know that is, we can have different suggestions, but there's no perfect model up until you test it and it has been proven that yes, it works. So there's no superior argument up until it's tested, and that's basically that in economy. The assumption, it remains assumption, up until those assumptions yield results. Thanks, I don't want to believe at the point.
Thank you, Komatandi.
Okay. Yeah, she asked me about here. Alan, can you look for him? Because we need to do the plan. Sorry? Okay, well, ideally I want to be with you, but can I just say firstly that, you know, it's interesting what Tandy said, because to a large extent I agree with her. I was going to make the same point. Firstly, I don't know Tandy and others here, but I think this has been like an extremely intellectually stimulating exchange. It's the best in that sense. I felt like I was a postgraduate seminar room. And I think it's partly to do with the issue, mainly VAT increase, partly to do with the far more active participation of civil society, including some of the academics and other intellectuals who are here, work and other intellectuals. And that's why it's been the case. Now, it's great that our horizons have been broadened. But like Tandy, I'm slightly, I don't know, I'm not strongly, I was looking forward to something more concrete to help us right now. We have to vote on this report on Tuesday in the committee and debate it on Wednesday. I also think that the debate is polarized because we represent different constituencies, different classes, different strata. But it's also polarized because we come to different, let's say, statistics, because we're comparing different things. Now, for an MP, even somebody of my years of political involvement, 45 years, and a master's in sociology and a diploma in journalism, I must tell you, it is very hard, actually. You read left-wing or social democrats saying that VAT is mildly progressive. When Momo started it, inside Momo, I said, don't raise that matter. People don't care. Right? Even if you're right, you're wrong. And then I look at left-wing academic things, right? And I've been doing a lot of reading, Tandy, and I was up till early hours of the morning for 2 days, and frankly, the more I read, the more I think I have to, right? So, you know, as the two chairs, and you've done a lot of reading over the weekend, and you gave us an excellent input, without a single note, by the way, on Tuesday. Really is difficult, right? So in view of that and a million other things, we are just MPs, man, even with my master's degree in sociology. What do I really know about the VAT increase and the modeling and so on? So why do we have to polarize things right now?
People can take to the streets, that's their right, but the final decision can't be made right now. Even if it was a collective decision of the ANC structures inside and outside Parliament to reject the VAT. I have consulted now with three experts, right? My understanding remains this, that if we reject the VAT in the fiscal framework, then we have to deliver alternatives, 22.9 billion. And the Appropriations Committee has to do that, but we can't just tweet without conferring with them and without providing a framework. That will not be politically sensible or fair. So, also, even if we say no to the VAT in the fiscal framework, that's a report within an act. It's not a bill. The bill is the Rates and Monetary Bill. Now, Section 7.4 of the Value Added Tax Act trumps any report, as I understand it. Now, civil society may argue that's your problem with your Money Bills Act. Fine. In phase two, we will look at that. But what I also gather in my little reading and hearing is that there are very few parliaments in the world that have this system. Often the presidents or the ministers or prime ministers announce these things and so on. I want to look into that, and Zakir and his team are going to do that. So let's move fast. What are some of the things we can do? We can, you see, I think Sean says it, technically, maybe, I don't understand Sean because he'll hit me hard and say, that, okay, I understand one person to say, because it suits me to understand it, that something could be technically mildly progressive, but it's politically regressive. Because the person out there in the street is going to pay an extra rand, say on the example he uses, 114 rand previously for 100 rand good, it'll now be 115 rand. It's a very large figure. Who's got 150 rand in front of? So I think it's putting it nicely. What I'm trying to say is that as politicians, in other words, I don't have a long discussion, right? But I'm saying the civil society is right to say many of the things they are. But you're also right to say many of the things you are, and we are also right to say many of the things we are. It's from the vantage point in which you're located. So I don't think we should say we agree and disagree. I think I agree with most things, even when they differ. I understand where it comes from, okay? Now the point then is, can't we, in the report, take a line that says something like this? We mentioned the stuff that we issued, Charles says, let's put it in the report, our press statement, reaffirm that we want this process of more consultation, the uniqueness of this increase, criticize to some extent National Treasury. I think Mr. Leach is right. The MTBPS was much looser. Not enough of a strong relationship with that and this, right? You refer to the political circumstances. That has to be taken into account. Also, to be fair, I have my policy and ideological differences as somebody who's not just a National Democrat, right? But to be fair to Treasury, I've changed my view. People will say you're co-opted. The truth is that these guys have had a formidable task, right? Formidable, right? Okay, we had the signs that the shortfall was coming, but the three basic educations put their issue on agenda. A comrade of mine from outside the public sector is saying, but you don't need the whole 57 billion now. You only need 12 billion, I think he said to me, and I raised this to you yesterday. And you explain how it's a three-year cycle. So I think there are very special circumstances here. I think Treasury is in a bind, the country is in a bind. And we shouldn't be pejorative each way. But the more I listen to civil society, and the more I agree with them, and the more I look at the technical issues, my empathy values, I think most of us, is a civil society. Right? Many of whom are our own constituents, the workers and the poor. But when I listen to the argument, it's very hard to question it. Right? So, bearing all that in mind, why can't we find a formulation? I can't deliver it now. We have to craft it over the weekend and send it to you people to look at, and by Tuesday you vote on it. Something that says that none of us, if you like, it's crude, it's the prestige here, right? So I don't know how to word this thing because then we could. That we are cautious about the VAT increase, is the softest way I can say that. And by the way, Kandi, I want to repeat. In a radio interview last week, I did not say the ANC caucus doesn't want this thing. I said the ANC study group within the committee, based on our exchanges with Dumasani and so on VAT 2 years ago. And then it's quoted by a newspaper that's saying out to the caucus. I don't speak for the caucus, Comrade Jackson does. But I have no reservation to say this is where the study group is for now. We would prefer not to have the VAT increase, and we're happy, we're glad it's not 2%. I did not say the caucus rejects it, because I don't have a mandate to say that. But I do have a mandate to speak for the ANC, because you see, just asked me, when you say we, who are you referring to? You know? So I had to reply, we mean the ANC component of a portfolio committee, the study group, right? I didn't speak for the caucus of the ANC. So the ANC has taken a decision over this weekend. Cabinet has now taken a decision. But you see, no matter how right, and we don't have to be supine to them, we are parliament. No matter how right VAT may be, we have to be politically and morally sensitive as politicians, even if it's the right thing to do, and have to take the view, this is their parliament after all, they vote for us. Not just because they're electioneering to me, because it's the right thing to do. So that's what I'm saying, comrades, colleagues. Let's strike a part that says we are cautious about the VAT, but we do not have sufficient alternatives nor a full enough understanding. And therefore, we are bringing forward, as we said, the public hearings on the rates and monetary bill. And we now have a date. On the 17th at 2 o'clock, I spoke to, that's what I was trying to reach out to you about, 17th at, on Tuesday when we come back, we tried to do it this month, it's impossible. We've got Capitec now, we've got Steinhoff, we've got a financial sector transformation report, we've got carbon tax bill, and we've got so many days left, and we're sitting now fully, right? So, on the 17th, so the first day we come back, we're getting a briefing at 14:00 because they are meeting in the morning. 18th, we start the hearing. But we will do it like this. I spoke to Judge Dennis Davis again yesterday, Tanti, on your recommendation, and we said to Judge Dennis, if you come today, it's going to be very squeezed. Why don't we start? You will brief people on the bill, including civil society, so that you know they have yet another chance to understand what you're trying to do. Then we have Judge Dennis Davis, and then we open it up for public hearing. That will be the first tranche. Secondly, we're going to put in our report, unless people disagree, that in any case you saying you're doing it, call civil society. Why we should also meet on the 18th rather than immediately? Because then it becomes like a feel-good response. It gives you people a chance to do what we ask you to do always. Meet with them. And bring Judge Dennis Davis, and they can bring whichever judge they want and have these things. We would recommend the first thing you do before we start the first is you give us a report on what you've done between Wednesday when you vote on this thing and the 18th when you appear here. What have you done and what are your plans? But we do not have to vote on the rates and monetary bill. The choice is ours. So we will engage with civil society and ask them, have we reached a situation that you feel you've been aired enough? Let's get a composite report and then we take a decision on the VAT bill. But we have to do it in a way that recognizes what Tami says, that actually what we have to do is ensure that we have got alternatives. Where will we get the money from, the 22.9 billion, as you rightly said? And then of course the 53 billion came on the 16th of December. It suddenly came there, and let's not enter that terrain, right? I mean, that too, the shortfall and so on. So, what are some of the things we can say quickly? On VAT, that's the approach, broadly. Then on other issues, comrades, colleagues, we can raise all the concerns of civil society in your summaries. And then we will say we would like further attention to be given to this luxury. It's not a multi-layer like Treasury is rejecting. There can be one category, and maybe they can explain, Neil, yourself, this, what do you call it, a luxury rate. So it applies to, like, fancy cars and so on. On aspects of what is ad valorem, whatever, in brackets we need to put that in English, right? I mean, really. Like, what does that actually mean, right? I mean, it's ridiculous to have that sort of stuff, right? In this day and age. Latin is not even in schools anymore, now I figured out. And not, Latin is not necessary for law, we scrapped it before. So can we just put that in brackets in future, right? So we look at that aspect, right? So that we make the poor and working class get clear that we are not excusing the upper classes and so on. Okay, so that's the approach broadly. Then on the Makwakwa, I was going to say something else. We must also put something in on the drought, obviously. Very important, right? And I think the drought has to be increased, the allocation, right? parts of KZN, everybody's affected. Then on the financial transformation report, they're wanting to, I don't think with the NNA coming in, they're going to rush into April. But I've been discussing with colleagues and comrades. I don't think they must rush into this financial sector summit. They must prepare the ground properly and have more discussions and negotiations, right? And it can be fine, they can have it at the end of April, not the 5th, the 6th, the 10th of April. But they cannot go ahead. We will march. Forget COSATU and SATU. We will march on Nene's office there across the road, and we will march on the summit. They must take seriously our extensive public hearings last year. Okay, fine. The president is not God, and he can review the situation and we can write to him, right? Nothing stops that. Then on the issue of quality of saving, that sort of stuff, people give some ideas. How can we tackle corruption more effectively? How can we improve the quality of spending, efficiency of spending, etc.? Then on this issue of the SARS Commission, I would like us to think that look on the Makwakwa matter, Alan Tebow, how many hours have we spent? Last week, Parliament agreed we can get Vincent Maleka to look into what we're entitled to. Now we've asked whether in every and any case you can say, no, I can't review this, the law says this, confidential stuff, right? We said, can Parliament do in the closed meeting and stuff? We asked client to do some work on it, we distributed, we haven't discussed it. But maybe the tax ombuds could have a role in that regard, right? So why don't we consider that we include, the expand the terms of reference to things like one, SARS handling of the Makwakwa matter, the LC matter, two, handling of the allegations against the high-risk investigative unit, the one that's called what, a rogue intelligence unit. And then while we fully support representativity of the National Treasury, and we urge that it happens, questions arise about whether the exodus of staff are related to some of these issues. Right? This, you see, if we do it in the Commission, they have latitude and power that we don't have, maybe. Not to say we won't do our job, they're coming here on the 13th to deal with those issues. But it saves us a lot of bother, because we're going around in circles. Have we made any progress apart from Jamie Maverick, Marion Merton? Don't do things like publish reports and then we get accused simply because our innocent advocate there, who's not a raving Marxist far-left activist, right? It used to be discussed, now they're accused of distributing what? Irregular, we were charged, we've been charged by the FIC. So, really, Daily Maverick, please behave, right? Then the issue also about this IFMS issue, to be fair, we do not know as Parliament whether skullduggery occurred there or not. But National Treasury is not above the law, as you agree. And you came and gave us a long input. And then he phoned me and said, Eunice, in your report you say nothing about it. I said, yes, simply because Scopus dealt with the matter, and it is a follow-up, Scopus must deal with it, and the Appropriations Committee met on a Friday and dealt with the matter, and then I repeated to my comrade, Yvonne Pinky Potter, listen, my sister, follow up on the IFMS thing, because it's about people's personal integrity here, right? And whatever else, ideologically and so on, might disagree, there's no sign to me that some of these individuals whom I know have stolen even a penny. They might have botched up and so on. Nevertheless, we can't drag on this IFMS thing. I will now once again speak to Pinky and tell her, please, sort this issue out, I'll speak to Themba. We're not putting in our report because it's yeah. Okay. Having said that, Themba, what's wrong with Themba? Themba is a Zulu name. I'm familiar with it. It's not a difficult for me Shivenda name. It's Themba. Right? And you speak Susutu mainly, right? So now, can we have Mr. Lees's response? Oh, firstly, what about to speak? That's broadly the trajectory, right? I have discussed some of these things, but maybe Shah wants to speak to it. That will be the broad trajectory of the report. What is the proposal from individuals here, right? And parties, not restricted to the DA? They have no more rights than you, Tani.
I'm not going to add to what the coach has said. I agree on both these.
Chairman, yeah, as I said earlier, we'll consider this and we'll give something in writing to add to it. A lot of what you're already saying is entirely in order, in fact, probably all of it, quite honestly. I don't think I can fault any of it. I would seek, if we're going to look into the kind of
shroud that we can't break through in terms of confidentiality, that if we're going to deal with the Makwakwa matter, that in some kind of format in which is legally possible, that we include the fringe benefits tax issues with regard to the previous President Zuma as well, because I think that's something that's very much out there, particularly now again in the Charles Taube book. We need to get to the bottom of whether that's been dealt with.
Honourable Tobias?
Help us to draft the report.
The recommendations are all over, but let me just capture this. Only the ones at the bottom that I have noted. One of them is how we going to fund the ECD program. They need to inject more funds. Most of the things that came, it's part of, they're not necessarily part of the fiscal framework, because there's limitations to change them. So if you understand, but those that I can highlight those at a later stage that will lead to the framework. But I wrote them all over.
Why don't you do the time? Like to the DA, can't you either dictate it to Zakaria over the phone? Because you're running, children are going to be here. So you can dictate it to Zakaria by this afternoon, or you can put in bullet points on an SMS or WhatsApp. Now, previously, we always asked Mr. Mania, because you see, we'd like to include your stuff in the draft, right? Where we reject it, we put it at the end and say, this is what we got from the DA. But in the last few years, you have not been presenting issues that we didn't agree with, interestingly. Most of your stuff gets included in a truncated form and it's reduced in language, right? But that's the editorial thing within the tour. So in short, can't you deliver it by this evening? Or 10 o'clock tomorrow morning? Fine, if you can't, you can't. You've done it before.
Mr. Chairman, David lives in Cape Town. As you full well know, I live in Mdambithi.
No, I understand all that, Okay, yeah. But you've got excellent staff from what I can see.
I do
most of the work.
I do, we do, and but it's still a political
Okay. Comment Peace, do you want to make the input? No? Comment Sheila?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to say, throughout my stay in Parliament, I have never believed that the blame for the problems of this country are caused by the executive and administration. I think it is ourselves. I don't think we are effective in oversight. Like what Momo said, we don't even bother to see that children get their allocation of food at 7 o'clock so that they can learn properly. We sit here in air conditioned rooms and we talk on reports. I think we should change our way of doing things. We must take the blame and change our way of doing things. Government has been working properly.
100% correct.
Okay. You know, this Illicit Tobacco Institute came to see me. Well, it's not the South African Tobacco Institute came to see me. Now, I tried to pull four people together, and after he failed twice on other issues, I said, it's a headache. We waste money on tea and coffee. I'm going to meet them on my own. But you saw the letter. I sent you their letter and my reply. How many other tears will do that? But they'll still complain, these guys. They are repressed and oppressed, and I'm hiding things from them as if I really like to hide. Nobody's complicit. Let's not discuss that. But Mr. Lee, so I think what we should put is a paragraph in that, you see, why I thought about it, Comrade Sheila Setole, Chope, because you see, we don't do our oversight properly. So they came to see us, and can you please listen, the two of you, because then you'll say there was no mandate, the chair was given no mandate, he's doing his own thing. Right. No. You know what?
They came,
and it was very impressive. Not that I approve of smoking and all that, but that's not relevant here, right? But they pointed to figures, right, even if they exaggerated. And if you read Charles Jacques Powell's, it comes out there a lot, illicit tobacco trade. Now I think basically we should have a city next quarter, put in our report. Oh, I didn't notice that you're there, because you say so many things and then you sort of, we lose you. 45,000 questions. You can't expect an old man like me to remember. But to come back to this illicit tobacco trade, we should put something in there, and we should have a meeting in the next quarter on it, and then we insert it into our quarterly review. Not only IFF, illicit. Why don't we do this for the 13th? Put it in there for Moyan, when Commissioner Moyan, when he comes to deal with that issue. Is that agreed? Yeah. But I just want to say before you draw it or close, that obviously you're going to thank civil society. I should say one thing, that the onus also, apart from us as Parliament, and we're going to insist the government does it, the Treasury does, the onus is also on civil society, right, to engage vigorously. You can bring people out on the streets, that's your right, but also engage vigorously around the nitty-gritties of zero rating and so on. Those sort of things. Sometimes, thank you. Yeah, the report usually, you'll recall, gets done, because this time we got three times the submission. Normally we send it to them around Monday noon, sometimes Monday in the afternoon. But this time around, because it's controversial, yet it's so difficult to finish, we started a lot of work. In fact, I've done 5 pages of a draft for the proposals, but I'm working with you on it, and I'll send it to you later. So we should hopefully get it out to you later on Sunday, otherwise first thing Monday morning. Let's see how it goes. Okay? Thanks. But over to you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kaleen. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, I think that this was a high-level engagement. Society enriched us with all your ideas. We call it the battle of ideas. Why? To get a better life. We are representing people outside, and many of them are poor people. Tomorrow this time, I'm engaging with some of them in Upington. Yes, 42 degrees tomorrow in the sun. There's no air conditioner. I can't. Rural as on a Chitolesi. That's our job. So thank you for coming and sensitize us. Look at the following. Thank you for the Treasury, all the members. When you travel safely. When you study this weekend, do it thoroughly, and prepare you in an excellent way for the debate for Wednesday afternoon, 2 o'clock in both houses. That brings us to the end of this meeting. This meeting is adjourned.